on understanding. The fear is more based on ignorance and not knowing. So what I like to do is I like to explain about vows in general, and I like to explain about the benefits of taking vows. And in fact, in more layman's terms, a simplified explanation of why we take vows. So I'd like to explain that a little bit because, as usual, if I have explained many times before, I can just go through it very quickly. The vows are like that, like that, like that, like that, and we just recite it and we do a dedication and we're done. But my style is always not to just do the ceremony, not to just do the initiation, not just to do the practice, and not just to do some oral transmissions and people feel that they have a blessing and they leave. Initiations, oral transmissions, and rituals and all that do have blessing. They definitely do have blessing. But the blessing will be opened sooner or later is dependent on the understanding. So let me repeat that. When we attend initiations and rituals and oral transmissions, etc., they definitely do have blessings. They do have blessings. The blessings can remain dormant for many years, or the blessings can remain dormant for a few years, or the blessings can be activated immediately. Is dependent on how we understand what we have received. If we have no preliminaries about initiations, we have no preliminaries about teachings, we have no preliminaries about anything that we're receiving, then we just think, hey, I've got a blessing. Yeah, you did get a blessing. But then again, what is a blessing? But then again, what happens after the blessing? Then again, what happens when you get the blessing? How do you activate the blessing? And a lot of people have a lot of confusion and misunderstanding about that. So I'd like to explain that more in layman's terms, more simplified terms, and more direct terms. And as I said very much, in my style, also in Kichara House, I'm very much interested in doing fundamental, basic, principle practices. And I like to focus on fundamental, basic, and principle practices because if we do the basic, fundamental, principle practices well, even if we enter into Tantra and we receive the initiation and the commentary and the correct oral transmissions, then we can achieve the results very, very fast, as it states. Sometimes, within one lifetime, within seven lifetimes, within 14 lifetimes. 14 is the max. We can gain full liberation. So what happens is that is possible if the preliminaries are done well. If the preliminaries are not done well, how much we engage in Tantra, we will not get the result, even in 14 lifetimes. In fact, it can be the very cause of us taking a lower rebirth. The actual cause, no, but giving a child millions and millions of dollars in a bag to carry on the street, a three-year-old child, whose fault is that? The child's fault or the giver? That it can be stolen or taken away. The child will not know how to protect it or its value. Similarly, when you give initiation or practices to people who are, at this stage, not ready, it is similar to giving a lot of money to a child and then asking them to take it across the street to another destination. So similarly, what I want to explain is that I'm very much focused on fundamental practices, basic practices, practices based on the Lam Rim and the three principal paths, and the eight verses of thought transformation, especially Lojong, or mind transformation teachings. And then those who stick around, those who are patient, and those who attend teachings and pujas, and take Dharma to the core of their life, not once in a blue moon, but the core of their life, then later on, by examination and by personal choice, I will pick those people. I will personally choose those people without anybody else knowing and confer initiation upon them, the highest yoga tantra. And then at that time, quietly confer them the commentary and the teachings. That's what I'll do. I won't make a big announcement. I won't have a big prayer hall. I'll definitely not have flyers. Why? I've observed my great masters in the past do it that way. In fact, His Holiness, Kyabje Shaba Chuji Rinpoche, Jesong Losan Nima, who has already passed away, quite often would give Vajrayogini initiations in his own room on top of Ganden. He wouldn't give it in Ganden's prayer hall. He is such a attained and very advanced master of Ajigini. He is, just for short, we call him Shaba Choji, or it means Lord of the East. The next one to take the throne of Lama Tsongkhapa. And he was the abbot of Ganden Shatse Monastery, chosen by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And he was the abbot of the lower Tantric College, Gyutu. And he finished his term as abbot perfectly. So he received double title of kinsir of both Gyutu Tantric College and Ganden Shatse Monastic College. He was a kinsir of both. So because of that, he achieved, by succession, conferred the title of His Holiness Shaba Choje, Lord of the East. And that would be next in line to Ganden, the Ganden's throne, the throne of all the Gelugpas, the highest Lama of the Gelugpas, which is called Ganden Chiba. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is a very high Lama of the Gelugpa school of Buddhism, but he is not the head of the Gelugpa school of Buddhism. But of course, that doesn't mean we don't treat him as one or respect him tremendously, no. So the official head of the school of Gelugpa school of Buddhism is Ganden Chiba. The current one is the 101st unbroken succession from Lama Tsongkhapa to his disciple, to his disciple, to his disciple, unbroken throne holder. So we call him Ganden Chiba. Ganden is Ganden, or Gelugpa. Chiba is the holder of the throne of Lama Tsongkhapa. So His Holiness, Kepje Shaba Choje Rinpoche, Jesun Losan Nima, we'll call him Jesun Losan Nima, exalted Losan Nima, renowned for his practice. After he finished his abbotship, in fact, he stayed in Bomdila, and he entered into a great retreat, Nianchen. And that is 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days. He got a small room in the hills, away from the village, away from the monastery. He's a monk, a fully ordained monk. And he used to go into the forest himself and collect the wood and bring it back, and his students and people will catch him chopping it and preparing his own wood to cook his own food to stay in retreat. And he stayed in the retreat of Vajrayogini for 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days. That's the exact number you stay. And he recited Vajrayogini's mantra, Bum Gya, over 10 million. 10 million. That's along with the rituals of Vajrayogini. That's along with making offerings. That's along with extended meditations and also with the 11 yogas. And he did that. The 11 yogas and the long sadhana and the meditations and offerings 4 times a day, because there's specific times, 4 times a day he did it. And on top of that, in between the mantras, and then at night, you don't take a break. At night, you engage into the sleep yoga of Vajrayogini. And he did this for 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days, together with advising the monasteries, because the monks will come and meet him, the new abbots will come and meet him for help and assistance. Along with that, he would also take care of the local lay people. The many, many lay people would come to him for divination. He wasn't left alone. Many, many lay people come for divination on top of that. So what I'm saying is he is such an incredibly busy individual. And he never, ever complained, not du tsu mes, which means I don't have time. Never. You never, ever heard His Holiness mention even once, I don't have time. Or, I can't squeeze the time. Never. An incredible thing is all his time was used for helping others. Taking care of others. Taking care of others' needs. Whereas a lot of people today, they say, I don't have time, but their time is into jobs and work and money pursuits and relationship pursuits and self-pursuits that only take care of a few years for this lifetime. That whatever they pursue only helps them for a few years in this life. So that is not judgmental in good or bad. That is more realistic in short-term benefit or long-term benefit. So the incredible thing about Shaba Choje Rinpoche was that he was very, very busy, but he was busy 24 hours taking care of others. And at the same time, along with that, engage in retreat. So you would start something like 3 a.m. and finish just before dawn, around 6 a.m., have your breakfast, take a break. Then you would start somewhere around 8 a.m. and finish before noon, before the noon sun hits the center. So before 12. Then you have your lunch and take a break. Then in the afternoon, you start around 2 p.m. Again, you begin your meditations and your recitations and practice and the yogas until around 5, 5:30. Then you would take a break, and then you have your dinner, take a rest, and then you start around 7:30 or 8 p.m., and then you would finish before midnight. And that was your schedule every single day for 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days. And so in between, His Eminence, His Holiness, Shabachuji Rinpoche, those betweens, the middays, in the evenings, sometimes He would have no rest or time to eat, but He would take care of the populace. And He was very well known in North India, Bomdila, as an extremely straightforward Lama, can be quite fierce, he can tell you off, but no one took offense, because in Tibetan tradition, the Lamas are respected for whatever actions they manifest for people. And he's very direct. He is well known for, we say in Tibetan, Pelek Chap, he is well known for not entertaining people, entertaining sponsors, entertaining this group or the powerful people. Because usually the Lamas have to entertain people to get their support, to help their center or help whatever they need to grow. He wasn't afraid of that because he just wanted to do his practice. And so he was so incredible. Finally, he finished his 3 year, 3 month, 3 day retreat. He did 10 million Vajrayogini mantras along with her long sadhana, along with her 11 yogas daily and the sleep yoga at night, all night. The sleep yoga is all night. You engage in it while you're sleeping. So that even when you're sleeping, it becomes something that makes your mind sharp and quick and excellent. So in Vajrayogini's Tantra, we sleep for one-third of our lives. For one-third of our lives, we sleep. We have to sleep. You know, we have to. It's not that we want to. Call it attachment, call it, you know, pleasure, call it a waste of time. Whatever you want to label it, we have to sleep. I have to sleep. That's what our body needs. So what happens is in Vajrayogini's Tantra, what is incredible is that even in your sleep, you do something prior to your sleep. There's a special type of meditation you do, a special type of motivation you do, that before you sleep, that when you sleep the whole night, you are engaged in this meditation. And as you do it 1 day, 2 day, 1 month, 2 months, you get better and better. Your sleep becomes very, you can control your sleep to be very deep or very light, and your sleep becomes very sensitive and very attuned. So actually, your body is resting, but your mind is still meditating. You can engage in that kind of after initiation. After. So what happens if a student is very loyal and always attend and very cooperative and takes the time out for Dharma on a regular basis, then that will make one of the factors for them qualified to take the initiation in the future. Why is that? Because for practice, you have to be steady. You have to do it every day. You have to be very systematic and steady. Why? To overturn your habits. So therefore, before initiation, the Lama is training you up, and you're not consistent. You're somehow uncooperative due to a lot of delusions. But there's a lot of excuses, and you don't do this, you don't do that, and you make up a lot of explanation. That's okay. The Lama is very kind. The Lama says, yeah, it's all right. You take your time. But you lose out. A, all the time is wasted for your training. That your training never ends. 1, 2, how long will your Lama live? How long will your Lama be alive? How long will you be alive? How long will the chance be there? Never wait for your old age to receive initiation. Very rare people in their old age can do their practice well. Very rare. A lifetime of habits. Very, very rare. Very rare. In fact, when we read about the Mahasiddhas, out of the 84 Mahasiddhas, I remember one coming out that was very aged that he received initiation in his 70s or 80s. His name was Tandipa. In any case, my point is what? It's not that old people cannot. It'll be a little harder. But it depends individually, of course. Individually. So why that? When we see people like Shabachuji Rinpoche, which I had the great fortune to serve, I had the great fortune to wash his holy body. A few times I begged him to give him a bath. So I took him into the bathroom, I put a chair, and I put just a boxer shorts on him, and I had the great honor. I made 3 prostrations to wash his body, because to serve our guru in such close proximity is considered extremely virtuous to purify our negative karma. In fact, when we stay in retreat, one of the dreams we can have is cleaning our guru's body. So I had the great fortune to actually book a hotel room and take him for medical checks and then clean his body, wash it, and cut his nails, cut his toenails, clean his nails. And even I had the great honor to wash his head. And after I finished washing his body and rinsing it off, I had the great honor to put a little bit of Dettol in the water to freshen his body up. And then clean him up and powder him because it's very hot there. And then escort him to the chair, to the table, and put his prayer book in front of him. And then I order him a meal. And I had the great honor to actually offer him a meal. And I did that many, many times. I did that for many of my gurus. But Shabachuja, I remember very fondly. He's already passed away. Incredible. Incredible. So my point is what? Is that this great master finished his 3-year, 3-month, 3-day retreat along with his schedule, along with teaching. And he even got his own firewood. He even chopped his own firewood. And he was just about to enter another retreat. Same, 3-year, 3-month, 3-day. And the Dalai Lama's letter came down that he became the abbot of Ganden Shartse. So he had to come down and become the abbot. So when he became the abbot, I had audience with him and I met him and I talked to him and I realized that he is a living Vajrayogini. In my mind, for the rest of my life, I felt he's a living Vajrayogini. I didn't see, of course all my masters are highly attained and they have connections to different lamas, different lineages. Example, when I met Kepje Lingarumchi, I always get a feeling he's Yamantaka. When I see Kepje Sonarumchi, I always get a feeling he's Hiruka. Always, the feeling I get. But when I met Shabachuja Rumchi, after I known him and talked to him, I always felt I was in the presence of Vajrayogini herself. And so when we say Vajrayogini her and Shabachuja he, that is on our reference point that it has to be a her or he. We're talking about the level of Buddhahood. Vajrayogini is a Buddha, the end. So therefore, I always felt I was in the presence of Vajrayogini. So when I was able to cut his nails, wash his body, offer him food, massage, I would always beg my teachers to allow me to massage their feet. Because in Tibetan and Indian tradition, the feet is the lowest part of the body. In order to destroy one's ego, in order to destroy one's self-grasping mind, it's very good to go to the lowest part of the body of our gurus and show service. Always I would do that as much as possible. And so anyways, when I met him, when he was the abbot, I asked him, if you didn't become an abbot, what would you do? And he said to me, oh, I was going to enter into retreat, just like that. I said, really? I said, what retreat? He said, same one, again. I said, but you're already finished. He says, it's not a matter of finish or not finished. It's a matter of we have gained Buddhahood or not. There's no limit to one's retreat. There's no limit to one's practice. It's whether you become a Buddha. And so he humbly said, oh, I'm not a Buddha. I want to enter retreat. And then something struck me very deep. I complained much, much less about not having time to do Dharma practice. I complained much, much less about not putting time toward Dharma practice, because what I realized from Shabachuja Rinpoche is just, it's your priorities. Now here, what's very important to realize is we cannot separate Dharma practice from life. We cannot. If we separate Dharma practice from life, we have understood the Dharma incorrectly. If we separate life from Dharma practice, we have understood life incorrectly. Life and Dharma practice are one, because Dharma practice is not something you do in a room, closed away, locked away. Dharma practice is something you do 24/7. But in order to reach that level where you can do Dharma practice out of a cave, in today's modern times, we need to listen to the teachings. We need to engage in the teachings, we need to listen, we need to read, and we need to saturate our mind with Buddha's teaching. That's very, very important. So for me, I find it extremely important that we learn the fundamentals and the basics to the point where we practice. Some people say, but I've heard these before. Yes. Are you practicing? Some people say, oh, I've listened to these before and I know them very well. That's very good. But are you practicing? And then some people even say, hey, these teachings are very simple and ordinary. And then you say to yourself, that's true, but can you practice? Can you practice? That's very, very important. And if you say, yes, I can practice, then the next question should be is, are you practicing? Are you? And if the answer comes out, yes, I am practicing, then the next question is coming out, then you must introspect very strongly. And this one is where Buddhism comes in very strong about introspection and self. Then you must introspect and meditate and think, how have I changed since I listened to the Dharma? How have I transformed? Is there any physical signs of my transformation? Is there any mental signs of my transformation? Is there any signs of my transformation within my speech? Speech doesn't mean it becomes gentle or nice. As I said many times, some people have very soft and very nice and gentle speech, but it's very cutty. Some people's speech is very loud and annoying and very direct, but if you listen to them long term, their loud speech doesn't hurt you. But if you listen to a soft speech, their soft speech is very cutty. So it's not the level or the decibel of the speech. It's not even the words. I know some lamas that just use curse words and curse you out when you do something wrong. But if you listen to them long term, what are they cursing you about? There's a difference. I've come from a long line of many, many gurus and many, many masters. And I've seen many styles. Any style can suit me because I'm there for the Dharma teachings, not to judge them. So therefore, what happens is we need to introspect and say, how have I changed? Not how have the people around me changed. Not how have my partner changed, or my husband, or my wife, or my friends, or the people around me. How have they changed? No, you don't look at that. You look at yourself and say, how have you changed? Because let me give you something very logical. Please focus on this and remember this for your future. If you wish to blame others for your problems, if you wish to blame others for your mistakes, if you wish to blame or pin blame or put responsibility onto another person or persons for your disasters and problems and depressions and unhappiness, if you wish to do that, then you must give them control of your life. If you don't give other people control of your life, you can't blame them for your problems. Why? You control your life. Since you control your life, you decide where you go, what you eat, who you stay with, who you shack up with, who you become partners with, who you marry or don't marry or not marry at all, who you choose, and what work you do, and how much you, how long you work. If you yourself is in power of choosing what you wish to do and how much and how long or how little, then why is it when things go wrong, you blame others? So very logical. If anything goes wrong with yourself and you wish to blame others, then you must immediately give control of your life to others. Therefore, if they run your life wrong, then you can blame them. Then they say, well, my husband's like that, my partner's like that. But you chose your husband. You chose your partner. You chose. You chose them, and you chose to stay with them. You chose to be with them. It's your choice. And if you remain with them, that's your choice. So actually, you're in control. Well, you know, I'd rather be alone, and I'd rather be single, and I'd rather do what I want. It's your choice. And I can't do this, and I can't do that, because my husband doesn't let me, my wife doesn't let me, my partner doesn't let me. No, you let your partner not let you. You're in control. Some people say, oh, my parents don't let me do this, and my parents don't let me. I've heard that many times, especially in the East, where people, even when they're 50 or 60, still live with their parents. To me, it's not odd anymore, because in the East, that thinking is different. It's not good or bad, it's just a way of life. For an Easterner, people who leave their family 18, that's very odd too. So I'm not going to look at East or West, I'm going to look at it as a point blank facts. If you choose to live with your parents, then there are rules you need to follow. You have free room and board, free food, you have free care, everything is free. So if everything is free, that comes with a price tag. You see, if you work outside, you're not free either. You're indentured to someone for 10 hours a day. So when you're indentured to 10 hours a day, you follow their rules, their dress code, their office, where you park, whether the weather is nice or not. You got to drive there. You got to be there on time. You got to do your work and produce. So if you got to work and you got to do and produce, if you got to work and produce, you're indentured to them for 10 hours. So what's the difference if you're at home, indentured to your parents for 10 hours? Because the bottom line is whether you work outside or you work at home with your parents, you've got to pay your bills. You've got to pay your commitments and take care of your commitments. But you choose to work outside. You choose to live with your parents. You choose to come under the dominion or domination of your boss. You choose to be under the dominion or domination of your parents. You choose that. So if you say, my boss doesn't let me do this, I can't attend this, I can't do that because I've got to work, I can't do this, I can't attend that because my parents won't let me, don't ever blame them. If you keep blaming them, in the end you will look silly. Why would you look silly? Anyone with any knowledge of Dharma will think deeper and say, no, but you chose that. You chose to live with your parents. You want the freebie. You want the freebie life. You want the easy life. You don't want to go out and work. I mean, there are many more reasons that are justified also. I'm just giving you a general one. That what I say doesn't fit for everybody, of course. Of course not. Everybody's quite unique in their situation. But the point here is you have given control. So if you take control, you have to blame yourself when anything goes wrong. So if your kids come out scary, they don't listen to you, or they become a burden for you, they're a financial burden, they're a behavioral burden, they're an embarrassment, and you've got to work hard and schlep, and you've got to give your life for them, that was your choice. You had those kids. You had those kids, they came out, and they're yours. So you never blame your kids for your problems. Never. You can't blame your kids for your problems. Why? It was your choice. Like my mother had a choice, but she decided to give me up for adoption. She felt she was too young. She felt she wasn't ready. She gave me up for adoption. So that's her choice. As a result, I don't have a relationship with her up till now. That's her choice. So whatever I say or do, my mother cannot blame me because she didn't take control of me. Similarly, if we work for a certain job and our boss is like that, our coworkers are like that, the situation's like this, like that, the hours are like that, the pay is like that, don't complain. Why? If you're going to complain, then you give control over others of what you're going to do, what you're going to earn your living. So if other people tell you how you're going to earn your living, you got to do it. Then when you do what they say and then problems come up, then you say, but you told me. Then you can blame them. So in life, it reflects Buddhism. Buddhism reflects life. In the West, some people like to term Buddhism as a way of life. Of course, it doesn't fit the definition as a way of life, but it's very unique because it can be used as a way of life without saying, I'm officially a Buddhist. And that's the incredible part about Buddhism, is that it can be a religion and a way of life and both. But actually, it is definitely a way to liberation. So what happens is, if you don't give control to other people for what you do, then don't blame them. Don't blame your husband. Don't blame your friends. Don't blame anyone. If you keep blaming, you will increase anger. You will increase the habituation of looking at things negatively. You will increase the habituation of pushing the responsibility onto other people. So what happens is, blame can only be placed if you have no control. If you have control, you cannot blame. Similarly, if you're doing your Dharma practices, there are many, many attained people out there. Many attained people. And then there's us, who's not attained. So some of us say, oh, I don't want to do the practice. Oh, I give up. Oh, I can't do it. Oh, I have interruptions. I have distractions. I have problems. They always say that. But you see, you have to understand, you can't blame the practice that you didn't gain attainments or transformation of the mind, because you're in control of how much you put into the practice. How much you put into the practice is how much you get out of it. So you can't blame. And there are people in ordinary life who do all kinds of jobs and adventures, and you know, they do all types of, you know, vocations, and they sometimes become successful and sometimes they don't. And when they're not successful in their vocation, they like to blame other people. I'm not saying that other people are blameless. Other people are factors, yes, but they're factors. So my point is, if we choose that profession, we know what it entails. We know the type of people where we have to get involved. We know the type of attitude we have to get involved with. So if we know that, then we can't blame. We can't blame. So let's say that we want to sell DVDs illegally. Or we want to sell dolls off the lorry. And then we get caught and we get put in jail, or we get fined, or we get in trouble. We can't blame friends. We can't blame people who introduced us. We can't blame the police. We can't blame anyone. Why? We chose that. Similarly with our health. If we are unhealthy, if we are overweight, and we don't discipline our bodies, and we don't want to take care of our bodies, and we just let it go down, 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 then later, when our bodies become a tremendous financial burden for us and for the people we love, and let's say we have $10 and $3, $4, $5, $6 have to be spent on our health and our medical and hospitalization and our medical medicines and our special diet, and then we have $3 or $4 left for the rest of our family or whatever we want to do, and we have no freedom, and then we can't blame it on health. Why? Because we chose to be unhealthy. We chose it. We chose not to take care. We chose to smoke. We chose to drink. We chose to be a glutton and eat nonstop. We chose not to do exercise. We chose not to keep ourselves fit. We chose that. I mean, of course, I'm telling you there are individual cases. There are people who are totally fit and whatever, and they take care of themselves and they get sick. I mean, that's a different situation. I'm talking about in general, as usual. So like that, when we're unhealthy and we don't keep ourselves fit and well, we chose that. How did we choose that? By not getting up and doing our 1 hour of exercise. That when we see a buffet, by limiting ourselves to 3 plates, not 20. By eating a slice of cake, not leaving a slice and eating the rest of the cake. We chose that. A lot of us do that. I do that. I leave one slice and eat the rest. Because I'm a bodhisattva and I want someone else to have a piece too. So I'm very nice. I usually eat one slice. Sometimes if I'm in a very generous mood, I leave 2 slices. Then I eat the rest of the cake. And so the next day when I get up, I'm bloated, as usual. My stomach is hanging out. I get measured for my clothes, and my waist is double its normal size. Then I have no one to blame but my generosity of leaving 2 slices for everyone. But that's my choice. That is my choice. So similarly, some people have problems and difficulties. And divinations and pujas are given to them. Special practices and divinations and pujas are given to them. And they have all types of excuses and all types of reasons that I've heard many, many times already. No one has come out with an original excuse yet. If they do, I'll give them a reward. I really will. I'll give them something really good. I haven't heard anything original yet of why they don't do their practices or the pujas, or why they can't. Why they can't do it. And then they tell you all types of mental reasons, psychological reasons, time factor reasons, parent reasons, outer reasons, work reasons, money reasons, financial reasons, all types of reasons that they can't do it. Why? Because they're still blaming others for their problems. So if we choose to continuously blame others, or even not knowing, here blame others, and our mouth is usually complaining about others, then we have to take control back. That's what I do. Sometimes I throw a BF and I take control back. I don't give control to people. Sometimes I see them doing this and this, I don't. Sometimes I see some of the assistants in the monastery, sometimes even here, they do things continuously in a funny way, I take control back. Why do I take control back to be cruel and vicious? No. So I can't blame them anymore. They don't collect negative karma simultaneously. Even some guests, I give them full run of the house. I let them do what they want, meet who they want, feed them, take care of them, everything. And sometimes when they say things that are quite funny, that are quite damaging to themselves, ultimately, I take control. I say, no, please don't say that. Please don't do that. I tell them very nicely. I talk to them. I take control. Why do I take control? Because when I give control, it's like that. When negative, detrimental things come back, I have to take control. But taking control is not so easy because why? It's a lot of responsibility. It's more work, more hassle, more time, more meeting. But take control, blame less, give control, blame more. That's a very sad human predicament, but it is a human predicament. Therefore, the point of this is that life teachings and things we learn in life matches Buddha's teachings very well. Why does it match very well? Because Buddha didn't teach us anything that was not ultimately truth. Buddha didn't teach anything that was not ultimately truth. Therefore, whatever we listen to Buddha's teachings, we go, oh wow, that sounds very logical, that sounds very clear, yes. So the reason I gave you that is to blame you or to criticize you or tell you you're wrong or something is bad? No. The reason I told you about taking responsibility for your life is to help you overcome anger. Is to help you overcome anger, which leads to blaming, which leads to enemies, which leads to loneliness, which eventually leads to depression. When we blame others, it will lead to depression. So there are many, 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 many times. Many, many times I've had ladies come to me in the past, over the 15 years, that they're dating a married man. That with a married man, they don't get enough attention. They don't know if they're going to leave their wives. They love them. They've given so much time and energy towards them, but the man just can't reciprocate. And every time they go home, they feel very jealous. They feel very, very unhappy. And then they say, why did he treat me like that? He told me he loves me. He told me he's going to be with me. On and on and on and on. They go on and on. I listen. The first few times I actually investigated. But after about 15, 20 times of listening to that from different people, 15 women, you know, on and on over the years, on and on and on, I came to a conclusion. You chose that. You don't have self-respect. You don't believe you're a good woman. You don't believe you're worth someone's full attention. Because you don't believe in yourself and you don't respect yourself, then you'll take half a man and not the full man. You'd rather have half than nothing. And therefore, if you choose that, the other half that you don't have, the other half that you don't have, don't complain about. Why? You chose it. You chose that. So later on, when I would talk to them, when they come and see me, they wanted a magical, they immediately asked, is he charmed? That's why he doesn't love me? When you look at some of the women, I say, no. Maybe he should be charmed to love you. Yes, they ask me, is he charmed? That's why he doesn't love me? Is someone charming him against me? I said, no, he has a wife, dearie. Oh, I forgot about her. And I'm like, and then some of these women, they come in, they're actually really, really scary. Really frightening. Big mouth, rude, loud, obnoxious, mean, not very nice people, and very demanding and pushy. And then they ask me, why doesn't he love me? And I so much want to point to the bathroom mirror, but I don't. I don't. And some of these women are very controlling. It must be this way, this way, this way. You know, they paint their nails, they paint their face, they paint their hair, their clothes, push up, everything. And then they show up. They show up. Why doesn't he still love me? Maybe he's deeper than you thought. And that goes for a lot of men who complain about women that don't love him. They come to me many, many, many. I tell them the exact same thing. And some men have come to me about other men. They've emailed me also. Same. What's the difference? Love is love. Hate is hate. Jealousy is jealousy. So far, no women about women yet. complain, not yet, but I'm sure it's coming in the future, I'm sure. Our group, I told you, attracts the people that don't fit everywhere else or anywhere else. You have a home here. You have a home. And some of you say, well, I'm not that type. No, it has nothing to do with it. Even people who are very lazy and give about 10 minutes a week to the Dharma. That's why you don't fit anywhere else. You're home. So our group is wonderful. And those of you who is not interested in hours and hours and hours and hours of rituals, hours and hours of puchas and initiations and rice and hours, because I'm not interested either. And it goes on and on. And they tell you all kinds of deities with all kinds of arms and all kinds of colors and all types of eyes. And they got this power, that power, that. And all these rituals and they just all the horns and the bells, it's just ringing away. And after 6 hours, you put your donation, you go home, you go, oh, God, I need a Panadol. And you don't understand anything. But of course, you're not disrespectful. You need a Panadol because it was hot, it was noisy. But you definitely respect the Lama and the teachings of what happened. Definitely. Nobody here is so bad. But my point is what is, if you're not interested in that, you found a home. Rinpoche doesn't believe in long, protected chanting, ritual, prayers that go on for all day and all night. He doesn't believe in that. Why doesn't he believe in that? It doesn't fit the people here. I like it. I love the monastery. I love the pujas. But it doesn't fit the people here. Because here, people got to work. Out of great compassion for the world, they decided to produce more kids so that we don't run out of the human population. You know, they're very kind. And for the sake of all sentient beings, they live with their parents so that they can meditate more at home so they don't have to go to work. They're very kind. And they engage in work. They work 60, 70 hours a week so that they can save up a lot of money so that they can, you know, be Mother Teresa when they're 120 years old. They're very kind. So for people here, I don't like those hours and hours and hours and pujas, because I find that after many years it doesn't help. How did I come to that conclusion? You have to remember, when I first arrived in Malaysia, the first few trips, I traveled all over Malaysia and I went to many, many centers of all lineages, all cities, small and big, all over. And I've experienced people. Immediately asked me, hey, Rinpoche, what initiation are you going to give? I said, no initiation. I said, really? I mean, later on, in the beginning, I was giving out initiations too. They're like, really? No initiation. Then what are you going to do? I'm going to give a Dharma talk. Dharma talk, huh? Less people, quieter. Some people get up and leave. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me at all. Why? It's their merit whether they can receive the Dharma or not. If they have merit, they'll be alert, they'll be awake, they'll make the time, they'll arrive. If they don't have merit, that's all. Why? Why does it depend on merit? Listening to Dharma talk changes your attitude. Changing your attitude brings about a better disposition and better reaction and better action from you. So in order to have a better reaction action, that's based on knowledge. That knowledge comes from Dharma. So in order to receive that, to have a better life, you need merit. Gong. If you don't have merit, you can't change your action. If you can't change your action, you won't have the opportunity to listen to the methods of change. So if you can't listen, you can't attend Dharma talk. So if you can't attend Dharma talk, you don't have time, you don't make the time, or you don't do it, it's a very clear indication that either you don't want to change your action, or you're not making an effort. If people say it's out of my control, then I disagree. Then Buddha wouldn't teach us teachings on how to become an enlightened being. Then he would say everybody's out of control. Why turn the wheel of Dharma? Why? Why did Lord Buddha tomorrow, 2,500 years ago, turn the wheel of Dharma? Why? Because he knows we can change our situation around. Otherwise, there's no point to speak. So therefore, the point here is, if we stop blaming others, our daughters, our sons, our husbands, our wives, our partners, our friends, our business, our bosses, our lamas, let me highlight that one because I'm very, very unbiased. Our lamas. If we stop blaming everybody else, things will change around quite a lot. Then how come we can have a girlfriend and we cheat on her, or we're insensitive and we're fat, tired, TC, ineffectionate, closed, cold, really uncaring, selfish, football-mongering glutton. And then when she wants to leave us or she's not happy with us, Why don't we go crying to our friends and drink beer and make ourselves more drunk? Or we contact our lama, please save my wife, save my lover for me. You had control. Your wife, your lama didn't sleep with your girlfriend. Your lama didn't do anything to your girlfriend. Why does your lama have to step in to save you? Then your business goes wrong. You didn't keep your accounts. You spent here and there. You're a big spender, Mr. Big Spender. You give big ang paos. You want to look good. You go everywhere. You want to be Mr. Big Shot. So you overspend. You're making $10. You spend $20. Then you find yourself bankrupt and you go to lama. Help, help, help my business. Help, 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 help my business. Mantra, mantra, mantra my business. Puja, 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 deity, magic, magic my business so I can be rich. So I can help the Dharma. Oh yeah, I heard that one before. You weren't helping the Dharma before when you were rich. Why would you help now? Because you helped me. My point? I didn't spend your money. I didn't run your business. I didn't do your accounts. I didn't do anything with you. So why is it when you have the money, you do what you want. When you get the money, you should ask me, what should I do with it? Then when you lose it, I'll help you out. But if you don't do anything, you don't consult me when you spend your money, how you spend your money, where you spend your money, when you spend. You don't consult me at all. But when you spend it all, it's all gone. You come, you say, Rinpoche, help me. Come on. Where got like that? Some more, you consult me about your girlfriend. Hey, when should I sleep with her? How many times? Should I be nice to her? Should I give flowers? Should I talk nicely? Should I show respect to her? Should I stop treating her like a piece of garbage? Should I stop having affairs? If you come and ask me instructions on how to treat your beautiful girlfriend, your beautiful wife, and you listen to what I tell you and you do it, then when she says she wants to run away, I'll interfere. But if you don't give me control or any kind of involvement in your relationship, which I don't want, thank you, with your girlfriend, with your boyfriend, with your partner. You don't. And then when you mess it up, you come to Rinpoche, solve it. Where God? Where God? Or Rinpoche not powerful enough, you go to Setrap. Solve it. Solve it. Same thing. Setrap didn't sleep with your girlfriend. Setrap didn't spend your money. Setrap didn't sleep with your girlfriend, your boyfriend, didn't spend your money. Setrap didn't do your accounts. So why does Setrap and Rinpoche gets dragged into the mud? And then some more, if Rinpoche don't respond, or Rinpoche gives you something and you don't do it because you're lazy, or it's too late, or the karma's already open, they say, pray. That Rinpoche, no power one la. Let's go to another one. Then we look at the catalog, you know. Which Rinpoche is coming from? His Holiness, His Eminence, how many incarnations? Which emanation, which Buddha is? Oh, he's a Buddha emanation, Buddha Avalokiteshvara. Oh, he's very powerful. Oh, he's got that bigger hat. He's from that lineage. He's got 16 lifetimes. Oh, let's go there. Maybe he can solve my problems. If he can solve your problems, let me know. I go to him, solve my problems too. Excuse me, Rinpoche. I've got these students who are lazy and get on my nerves. What do I do? My point? Think about it. Think about it. So if you're sick as a dog because you're 500 kgs and you eat nonstop and you won't, and Rinpoche has told you many times and warned you many times, even Rinpoche didn't tell you, you know, your doctor, your wife, your lover, your husband, your friend has told you many times, lose weight, exercise, something's coming later, be careful. I've experienced this many times, even recently. Even recently. With one lady I advised many years ago, lose weight. It will be very detrimental very soon. Do these pujas and do these practices. She didn't. Something happened to her very recently. Very recently. Now what to do? Now cannot do anything. Very serious. It will become more serious. Very recently I experienced it already. And I remember many years ago giving her advice to lose weight. And I gave her practices to do. Very clearly. Didn't listen. So the mother complained to me and tell me like that, like that, like that. I said, yeah, what to do? I don't have control of what she eats. She doesn't give me control. She doesn't give me control of her exercise, of her time, of her life. I don't want control. But my point is what? I don't want control, but I never had control, so why do you throw it on me when things go wrong? So if you have three kids, you have one kid, you have two kids, and they turn out to be absolute monsters, or they don't listen, or they take up your time, or they pull you away from your life, or they pull you away from your Dharma practice, they pull you away from business, they pull you away from freedom, and you have absolutely no freedom, nothing at all, you can't blame your kids. You looked at those Hindi movies, You looked at those movies from Bollywood where they dance around the tree, it rains, they make love to the beautiful Indian girl, and then they have the whole picture that they're married and have 3-4 kids, and it's all rosy pictured and hazy and tinted. They're like, hi, this is Priya Janka. And I'm Monash. And this is my kid Raj, Sita, and they go on, they're so happy. It's all fake. It's all fake. Then look at these Hollywood movies where the guy does everything to get the girl. He'll kill everybody, knock everything over, run over this, run over that, burn this, everything. And then in the end, he gets the girl. Just for that girl, he's killed this many people, destroyed this, like Arnold Schwarzenegger. You've seen his movies? How many people he kills, and buildings and cars, everything he destroyed for that one girl. And once he gets that girl, it closes off, he hugs her, she's beautiful and wonderful. Fast forward 10 years. Fast forward 10 years, let's see what they look like. They ain't happy anymore, they're on divorce court. And the kids are like, you know, they're confused. They cut themselves with razor blades because their parents are divorced, they're not happy anymore. What's my point? My point is, it's all a fantasy. It's not really like that. And if we choose it to be like that, I'm going to keep my hands down. Every time I go like that, he's like, okay, never mind. What's my point? My point is, those are just fantasies. Those are not real. So even if they're not real, we choose it. Some of us, we don't want to control our speech. We don't want to control our speech. We want to say whatever we want. We want to say when we want, when we want to say what we want, when we want it, as we like it, and to help whoever we want with no control of our speech. And whatever runs through our mind, however angry we are, we want to just express it to the person. And we don't want to change our lifestyle in any way. We don't want to give up anything that we're comfortable with. But at the same time, they come to Rinpoche and they have done that. What deity should I practice so I can get a relationship? And when I get a relationship, I won't feel so lonely. And may I get a Buddhist relationship so that we can practice together and help at the center without being lonely. Oh, I've heard that so many times. How do I get a relationship? How? And I look at him and go, you don't want one, you don't want one, you don't want one, you don't want one. Really. I give him pujas and things to do up to not get one. So 2 years later, like, I still didn't get one. I said, oh, poor thing. What happened? Oh, what happened now? So I tell them, be bitchy. Be as mean as you can. Cut the mask out of Ma Kala and wear that black with 3 eyes and fangs, you know. Do that. And whatever people say, say no, you're wrong. Keep doing that. That's going to work. And always have everything your way. And whatever they say, tell them off. Don't even listen. Just tell them. Tell them to fly a kite. Tell them. That's the magic formula to get in relationships. And sometimes I don't even tell them. They tell me. I go, oh, thank you. They think, but why am I not getting a relationship? I don't know. And then some of them, no joke. Some of them, oh my goodness. I've even consulted my gurus for them. What deities and what practice to get a relationship. And some of them get one right after they get one. Or quite a few, actually. After they get one, I'm not kidding you. After a few years later, they write a letter and they say, you know what? Letters, not emails. They write letters and they say, I'm really having a difficult time with my husband. He doesn't give me any freedom. He doesn't let me go to the center. He doesn't let me do what I want. And I don't know what I should do. And I'm not happy. I feel I'm locked in and I'm tied down. And I don't have any freedom. And you know, if you read their letters before and after, it's the same person, same signature, different dates. It's completely the opposite. Where they are saying they're lonely, they can't practice Dharma, that they don't have support, and that when they come home, it's an empty room, and it's cold, and there's no one there, and they talk, and because of this emptiness and this loneliness, they can't practice, they can't do more. Actually, it's not the practice they're interested in. It's kind of like a bribery, but it doesn't work on me. I'm not as stupid as I look, I always tell them. I'm not as stupid as I look. And so, you know, and then afterwards they say, then they can't practice because they have this relationship. How? And then, you know, when they have one, they're not happy. When they don't have one, they're also not happy. And then when they get another one, they're still not happy. I know people in the past where we've done divinations with high lamas, I've taken the Ganden, who told them, don't get married. Again. You can get married. You have the karma to get married. If you want to, you can get, but don't get married. I like that because you know why? Because the High Lamas and Ganden, they don't speak English, so these people get pissed off. They can write a letter to them directly. They don't have to ask me. I don't like divination. I like directing it to Ganden. Really, I do. Why? Because people like to blame me when things go wrong. So what happened? I told them. The High Lama did a divination for them, very High Lama. He said, "Don't your karma, you can get a relationship and married. But if you get it, your life will go down. Very clearly. Your life will go down. You'll lose control. Your finances, your health, everything will go down. Everything for you will go completely down. And you see later on in your life. Yapo Yomaris, Yapo Mendus, they'll say very clearly. And I translate and I tell them. They don't listen. I don't even know why they ask divination in the first place. They don't listen. And when you fast forward their lives and you look at them and you look that they've been married and what happens to them and what happens in their family or the family they marry into, you say, oh my God, the divination is definitely clairvoyance. Definitely. I've experienced that. Not once, not twice. Many, many, many times. So what's my point? Is that people want to hear what they want to hear. When you don't tell them what they want to hear, then they do what they want. And when they do what they want, when it doesn't come out right, then they come back and listen to you what you have to say again. And if what you say is what they want to hear again, then they might do it. But if you tell them what they don't want to hear, then they say, oh, I don't understand your method. I don't understand your training. I don't understand the Dharma. I don't understand that level. I just don't understand. It's not that they don't understand. They're used to blaming others. They're used to not taking responsibility. Why are we in Dharma? To listen to someone on a throne telling us we don't take responsibility and scolding us? No. We're in Dharma because we've reached the point in our life. Listen very carefully. We're in Dharma because we've reached the point in our life that we're ready to hear the truth. We're ready. We're ready for someone to tell us the truth. And sometimes the truth is quite liberating. A part of us will be uncomfortable and wince, a part of us, because we're guilty of that. But we have to realize we don't need to wince because we are in control. A part of us will wince, another part of us will feel relief, and a bigger part of us will think, wow, I've known that all this time. I've understood that. I just needed someone with a title on a throne and a lot of robes to tell me all this, and then I say, oh yeah, that was true. Buddha doesn't teach us anything we don't know. Buddha doesn't give us enlightenment. Buddha develops enlightenment within us. We have the potential. If we have the potential for enlightenment, then everything that the lamas are telling you is within you already. It's just that needs to be developed. So therefore, if we have problems and difficulties, If the karma has not ripened, you know, you don't plant a small little sapling and you want an apple tree. And then when it grows, all the leaves, all the color, the characteristics, the bark, the size, the thickness, all that turns out to be a lemon tree. So you got yourself a big lemon. And then you say, oh my God, I got a lemon tree, but I want an apple. So before that big tree grows up, or even halfway, you cut it down or get rid of it or transplant it and you put an apple tree. So when the lemon tree comes out, you don't sit there and complain for the rest of your life, but I wanted an apple tree and all I got was a big lemon. Isn't that like that for most of our lives? I got a big fat lemon. And then some of us who listen to Dharma, we find out that we didn't get any lemon. The lemon was us. The actual lemon was us. So my point is, when we listen to Dharma or we attend Dharma, this is the point. It is not to have someone telling us what we know or what we heard or what we understand. No. When we listen to Dharma, and it comes from a person that we feel is qualified or is practicing what he or she preaches, the real purpose of that is this, is that we are ready to listen to the truth. We are ready. And when we listen to the truth, a few emotional things will happen within our mind, a few emotional stages. Denial, acceptance, anger, happiness, release, relief. Many things will happen. But the point is, sometimes we need a therapist to tell us. Sometimes we need a lama to tell us. But whatever it is that's telling us, it's not telling us anything we don't know. And most of the time, for many of us, we've run away from what the therapist, Lama, has been telling us. And that's the sad part. And a lot of years go by, a lot of time gets wasted, and a lot of relationship is destroyed, a lot of opportunity is missed, and a lot of regrets. Regrets are quite depressing. You know what are regrets? Regrets are things we could have done and we didn't do, but we could have done it. See, it's not something that you could not have done. How could you, I regret I couldn't fly. How could you fly? You don't have wings. You don't have wings how to fly. I regret not, being a catwalk model. You know, like, if you're 500 kgs and you've got a double chin and your hair grows only in your armpits, it's going to be pretty hard for you to be a supermodel, right? No offense to anyone. Not that being a supermodel is anything great, unless you want to die of anorexia, which is happening now. They have a new ruling out, right, in the papers in the United States. If your BMI is not above 18, you're not allowed to do catwalk modeling anymore. And there's no rules or anything, but it's kind of frowned down upon because, you know, that famous Brazilian model died of not eating. Complications from not eating. Complications, not actually not eating. So what's my point? Now the industry is like, if your BMI is not above 18, whatever that means, you know. Trust me, my BMI is probably 55. But anyways, it's not my problem anymore. It used to be. I dabbled in the arts of not eating for a few seasons. I dabbled. But I'm not into that anymore. I was anorexic and I healed myself. I chanted to the Buddha of anorexia. And I've healed myself. And now I'm fat and happy. I think. Okay, so what happens is, if you give control to others, then you may blame. If you don't give control to others, then you can't blame. So the next time you want to open your mouth to blame or complain or bitch or say something that pushes the responsibility onto another person, meditate and think deeply, very deeply. Is that really the case? And you'll find a lot of relief. In the beginning, it's very hard. It's very, very difficult. It's very hard and very difficult. Why? Because we're so habituated towards that, you know? You know, when we watch movies, we watch TV, we always see people, it's your fault, it's this. If I'm in a different place, I'll be happier. If I'm a different guy, I'm happier. If I'm with a different clothes, I'm happier. If I'm with a different friend, I'm happier. If I have different parents, I'm happier. We're always saying we're happier if we have something different. But why doesn't it all last? Why doesn't anything we have last? Why is that? We have to think carefully. So therefore, when we listen to the Dharma and people say, oh, you're becoming fanatical. Oh, you're losing yourself. You're losing your life. You know, oh, you're not you anymore. You're not normal anymore. What's normal? What is normal? So what happens is, when you're ready to listen to the Dharma and you accept the Dharma and you practice and you make that a part of your life, a very center core of your life, you will see many things in your life change. You will not see your clothes, your hair, your relationship, your friends, your job, your money, your food, what you like, your apartment, where you like to live change. You won't see that change. But you will see that these things will not affect your happiness anymore. These things will not affect your happiness. So what happens is, how do we reach that stage when someone tells us the truth? So therefore, today's topic, we're here to take 24-hour refuge vows. I'm sorry, precepts. 24-hour precepts. How do we relate what we talked about to precepts? Oh, it's totally related. It's fabulously related. It's, in fact, so related. They're not cousins. They're brothers. Very related. Not even adopted brothers, real brothers. Why is that? Why are we afraid to take vows? When we talk about vows, very few people will turn up. Very few people. Half the normal people will turn up if we talk about taking vows. Why is that? Because most people always say, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. I'm not ready. I'm not ready. It's like a mantra. I'm not ready. 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 10 million times. 3 years, 3 months, 3 days. I'm not ready. I'm not ready. I'm not ready. I'm not ready. Then they believe it. I'm not ready. It's incredible. I'm not ready mantra. I'm not ready. Why aren't you ready? Oh, when my kids grow up. Then you won't be ready because by the time you might be dead. When my business hits this point. You're going to work yourself to death by the time you reach that point. You don't have to take the vows. You won't be able to do anything anyway. I mean, if you're 600 years old, nothing on you is working, why do you need to take vows? You're not going to do anything bad anymore. Why take vows, you know? Why wait till you're 600 years old? I am. You can't even talk, you know. Then after you get the vows, what's the point? Some people say, I'm going to wait till I'm older to do dharma practice. I don't want to be bitchy and mean. I tell them, what's the point? Which old person goes out and collects all negative karma, drinking, smoking, sleeping around? They can't even do that if they want to. What's the point? Not doing it because you can't doesn't mean you're holy. Not doing anything because you can't doesn't mean you're holy. So if you don't lie anymore, maybe because there's no one around you to lie to. Everybody's dead. Your friends are dead. Your kids are living their life and they're like, you know, shut up. Drink a Milo, keep quiet. Then your mother, your aunties, blah, 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 blah. Drink your Milo, mama, which means shut up. So you can't even lie because, you know, there's no one to lie to. Then drink alcohol, you're allergic to everything. Shellfish, you're allergic to oil, you're allergic to white rice, you're allergic to vegetables, strawberry, you're allergic to everything. So you can't even take alcohol. So you think you don't take alcohol, you're so holy smolia. No. No, I don't think so. Then not killing. You can't kill anybody. You can't even lift your arm. How to kill? Oh. Paralysis or arthritis. You see some of these old people are arthritis. Like, how to kill? They can't even hold a knife. I'm going to kill you. Oh. I mean, come on. Why take the vow when you're 150 or 600 years old? What's the point? Then don't eat more than one meal a day. There are very few old people who could eat seven times. And most of them, they eat a little bit. They can't already. Like, I mean, you know, think about it. And you know stealing. How to steal? They can't even walk. Have you ever seen a senior citizen cat burglar? 600-year-old grandma wear a cat suit and he swings into your window? I don't think so. Oh, I know. We push the wheelchair in and they let them steal out. So when are you going to be ready? When are you going to be ready? When you can't do anything anyway and then you take the vows? No. When you say you are not ready, it's from fear. When you say you're not ready, it's from fear that you're losing something. You're not losing anything. Why do we respect the lamas so much? Why do we respect the nuns so much? Why do we respect great teachers so much? Why do we respect Trigyen Rinpoche and Dalai Lama so much? Why? Because they do everything we do? Why do we respect Her Holiness, Mother Teresa, so much? Why do we respect Reverend Cheng Yang in Taiwan so much? Why do we respect Nelson Mandela so much? Why? Why? And for many of us, in my era, it's His Excellency Mahathir. Why do we respect him so much? Because they give themselves to others. Why do we respect government ministers? Actually, they're ministers, you know, they rule and blah, blah, blah. Actually, the real basis of respecting ministers is that they cut away their time for their own money. They cut away their time for pleasure. They cut away their time for family. They cut away their time for their personal goals. They cut away their time for their free leisure time. And they use that time they cut away to run the government, run the country, so that all of us can have a beautiful country like Malaysia. So when the ministers show up, we give them the best chair. Because they're suffering enough working 24 hours a day or whatever it is. We give them the best food because we assume they don't get to eat good meals. And when they get very sick, we give them the best hospital care. We're happy to. Why? We want them to get well so that they can continue making the country great, so that we can lay back. Actually, we show them respect We give them good food, and we put them in a good hospital. And when they come across, you know, when they come across traffic, we move out of the way. Except me, I follow behind. You know, the police escort is the best way to get home fast. I just pretend I'm part of the crowd. They don't know who's the minister, me or them. So what happens is, why do we show that respect? Because actually, A, we respect them for what they've given us. B, if they're well and they keep doing their job, I can keep laying back and doing nothing. I wouldn't want to be a minister, no joke. I would not want to be a minister. It is not easy. Everybody looks at you. Everybody criticizes you. Whatever you do, there's going to be a faction that doesn't like what you do. However good you are, there's going to be somebody out there who doesn't like you or say something ugly or nasty. Always is like that. And you're dedicated to others. You have to give others. You have to be double better than others. You have to be double honest, double giving, double bodhisattvas. Why? Because you're expected to be a public servant. Plus, you call yourself a servant. So that's why we respect ministers, especially the ministers who do such a superfluous job. So in that way, the real reason why we respect ministers is because of how much they give to us. The real basis of respecting ministers, the real basis of respecting government and the king. And in this country, we all respect the king. We all respect the government, because look at our country. We're having a great life. Well, I am. We're as comfortable as we can be. And it's up to us. So therefore, when are we ready to take vows? Ministers take vows. Lawyers take vows. Doctors take vows. Husbands and wives take vows. Principals take vows. Ministers take vows. Presidents and prime ministers and kings and queens all take vows. Everybody takes vows. Everybody takes a vow because it's a reminder of what they should be doing all the time. So when we take a vow, the Buddhistic approach to taking a vow is what? The Buddhist approach, there are many, many levels, but I'm going to speak on just a few, not all. The Buddhist reason for taking vows is to help us to overcome our fears. If we don't cheat in business, I'm not going to make it. You know, if I don't lie, I can't get away with something. I have to kill. I need intoxicants. If I don't get intoxicants, I can't make it through another day. You see, that's all fear. Not being able to take vows is fear of becoming better. Not trusting you can become better. Fearing that you will fail. Not taking vows is fearing you will fail. That you will not be able to become a better person. That's why we fear taking vows. So we have to ask ourselves, when will we ever be ready? When will we have enough kids? When will we have enough of a relationship? When will we have enough of alcohol? When will we have enough of lying? When will we have enough of anything? So the presupposition here is, if I have enough of something, then I can take a vow. No. Your actual grasping towards these items that you find to bring you pleasure, but actually this pleasure and more problems and sufferings is the actual root of all your problems. So therefore, when you take vows, you are penetrating to the root of your sufferings. And when you take vows, you are actually rehabituating your mind towards a better path, a more positive path, and a path that will be beneficial for you, around you, long term and short term. That is why when we break our vow, we break our commitment or our samaya to our lamas, when we break it, it is extremely detrimental. Why is it extremely detrimental? On a karmic level, it's detrimental because we have sworn in front of something that is holy. On a lower level, it's detrimental. Why? Because we have reverted back to the darkness and we're afraid to accept the light. We have reverted back. How have we reverted back? Because we're used to being in the dark. So when someone's in the dark, you let in a little bit of light, they're scared. They don't know what to expect. But what they don't understand is, once you get used to the light, you won't want the darkness. What is light? A light is openness, is forgiveness, is acceptance of one situation. Acceptance with doing something about it, not anger and then do something. There's a difference. We make a change in our lives. How do we make a change in our lives? When we embrace the light, which is the light of our mind. What is the light of our mind? The good qualities that Buddha has spoken about. Example, the six paramitas. That is the light. The light is the six paramitas. And when we go towards that, it's very scary. Why? The light says we can't give up. And we want to give up. We want to give up. When it gets hard, we want to give up. Why? Because we've been doing that our whole life. We've been doing that our whole life, to give up. To just give up when something's wrong, when something's not right, when something's difficult. Just give up. Just go away, man. Just, you know, bye. You know, see you later. I quit. You know, here's my contract. You can keep your money or whatever. We're so used to saying that. And some of us, we're like actors. I've had enough. And I'm not going to take this another minute. You make me suffer. I'm leaving. Very dramatic. And some people cry and bawl, boo-hoo. And they cry, they drop tears, and how they don't want to leave, and how they don't want to give up, and how they tried, and, you know, how they pushed their effort, and how for the last 4 days they've done everything they can to be enlightened, they still can't. And you're looking at them like, okay, bye-bye. You outwardly say bye-bye, inside think, oh no, now how? Then the sixth part of me is tell you about Tsundru. Tsundru is effort, not to give up, to investigate, to check. And when you give up something, is it actually the object you're giving up? The reason is the object, or really it's yourself. Not to give up. That is the light. Why? Why is that the light? Anyone in the world who is engaged in any business or any action or any relationship or any type of practice, in the beginning it's very hard. And when they didn't give up, later when all the results come, people admire them. People praise them. People write biographies about them. People interview them. People talk to them. And then their life is used as an inspiration for others. People will give up. Who interviews? Hey, why'd you give up? Who cares? Why'd you give up? Oh, you worked there for 6 months, you gave up. Can you tell me why? Who cares? I've got enough hassle in my life to listen to your sad sack story, right? Oh, why did you give up the Dharma? Why? Why? Who cares? You don't want to add to your psychological problems already. You got enough psychological problems. You got enough mental traumas. You don't need to interview and listen to everybody who gave up. You don't need to. But you want to interview and talk to people who didn't give up. Because they inspire. And a lot of the things that they went through is probably much worse than what we went through. So when we listen to it, we go, okay, I'm not going to give up. Why are you not going to give up? Why? Because you realize that it's not just that person inspired you, because inspiration is for a short time. You realize, hey, I want to achieve some kind of stability. I want to achieve some kind of end. I want to achieve some kind of goal. So to achieve that, there must be effort. Effort is conjoined and is married to not giving up. So you embrace the light. So no matter how difficult, you push yourself, you push yourself, you keep doing, you push yourself. Eventually, you come out successful. Eventually, you come out shining. Eventually, you come out better. Those who give up and run away, give up and go away, give up away and hide, they go back to the darkness. Why do they go back to the darkness? Because they feel the darkness offers them some kind of light. Giving up doesn't give you light. Giving up puts you down even more and makes you even more depressed and unhappy. Not pushing yourself gives yourself even more unhappiness. Showing your anger to people and expressing your anger to people with the intent of anger, is embracing the darkness. Breaking the rules of the land is embracing the darkness. If we go and kill people, that's embracing the darkness. It seems easier immediately. It's deceptive. It's not easier. Why is it not easier? The repercussions are great. And that's what Buddha is talking about all this time. So therefore, we're afraid to take vows. We're afraid to take vows. Why? Some of us don't want to see our potential. Some of us feel that we will lose something if we take the vows. We will lose something. Some of us think that it's too hard and too difficult. And in fact, when you are afraid of taking the vows, That's how strong you can see your anger, your attachments, your greed, your impatience, your lack of effort. You can see how strong it is. Why? Because taking vows and holding them takes that type of discipline. The willingness to overcome, the willingness to change. When you're not willing to change and overcome, you don't want to take the vows. So let me tell you again, if you're not willing to overcome and change, then when you have difficulties and problems, you can't blame. You can't blame. You can't blame others at all. You can't blame anyone. You can't even complain. Why? You chose it. You chose it. Very rare do you hear high practitioners complain. Very rare do you hear monks complain. Very rare do you hear nuns complain. Very rare. Very rare. Why is that? They've taken responsibility. So therefore, when we're not able to take the vows, when we're not able to take the vows, when we're not able to, it's a clear indication to us, clear indication, how we don't want to, or we don't want to push ourselves toward a real change. And when we don't want to push ourselves toward a real change, we have to accept the results, that karma will catch up. Some people take on refuge vows and they hold it. Some people take on the pratimosha vows, the monk and nun vows, they hold it. Some people take on the bodhisattva vows and they hold it. Some people take the tantric vows and hold it. Some people take all these vows and they hold it. What about us? Buddha's happy birthday is coming up. When we have our happy birthdays, what do we want? We want cards. We want nice, cheap words in the cards. We want flowers. We want chocolate. Forget the flowers and chocolate. We want presents and ang pao. We want a big, thick ang pao. The bigger, the thicker the ang pao, the more we're worth and the more they love us. And we want parties. We want, you know, if we don't have money, then we have a party at Burger King. No, thank you. We get to wear a little Burger King crown and run around and dance and have balloons. Oh, dear. Then sometimes we have parties at our house. We hire a really sad clown to make us laugh. Actually, we're not laughing because he's funny. We're laughing because he looks silly. And then we have birthday parties and all our little fake friends come and have free food and free popcorn and free hot dogs and everything. And then we want everybody to jump up and down. Oh, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. I hate birthday parties. I've always hated them. And we want everybody to celebrate and give us something. Because on our birthday, we want to be recognized. We want the whole world to say, I was born, recognize me, I'm special. Okay, you are special. Happy birthday. Whatever that means. HB. Happy birthday. They make noise, give them a balloon, tell them go home. Now, Buddha's birthday is tomorrow. Buddha's day that he took rebirth, he took birth, the day that he became enlightened, and the same day that he enter parinirvana. So what do? Should we book Burger King for Buddha? Call the clowns? What happens if it rains these days? You know, the weather, global warming, all that rains every day. The minute I go walking outside, it starts to rain. I'm like, doesn't any of the gods like me? The minute I go inside, the rain stops. Like, I know they don't like me. It's a trick. Even Rinpoches get wet. Even Rinpoches get caught out in the rain. And sometimes I think, oh, thank God nobody's watching this. Why don't you throw your rice, stop the rain now, big mouth? I'm like, uh-oh, caught, no powers again. Now, that's why when I go running, I don't take new students because they're afraid that, you know, I throw the rice, it doesn't work, and I have to make up some other BS to cover it. Nope, I'm sorry. I can't control the weather. I can't make it rain. I don't know the Indian rain dance. And, you know, I can't do anything with the rain. In fact, the rain controls me. I look outside, it's raining. So what happens is, Buddha's birthday is tomorrow. What, you hire Burger King? Book Burger King for Buddha and throw a party? Put a cake in front of him. Oh, blow out the candle, make a wish. Buddha, make a wish? Make a wish, Buddha. May you be enlightened. I mean, you know, how does Buddha make a wish? What do you want? You give Buddha, you know, new lingerie. Happy birthday! A diamond ring, chocolates, candy, flowers. He said, "No thanks for flowers. I get flowers every day." And you know, what do you give to the Buddha? What do you give him on his happy birthday? What do you think the Buddha wants of you? Do you think Buddha is another desire, attachment, you know, stuck in samsara being who wants recognition, who wants name, who wants party, who wants gifts, who wants cards, who wants ang pao? Do you think Buddha's like that? I don't think so. If Buddha's like that, then we knock that statue off like Saddam Hussein's in Iraq and we sit on top. Power to the people. No. Buddha doesn't want your birthday and your recognition, all that stuff. What Buddha wants is for you not to suffer. But what Buddha wants is your mind to transform. What the Buddha wants is for you to gain control of your life and then become an enlightened being that can be a benefit to others. That's what the Buddha really wants. So if the Buddha wants that, how do you think we can achieve it? Run down the street naked, with knives in both hands, chop everybody up, lie, scream, pee on everybody, poop on the street, if the dog's pooping, kick him and poop in his place instead. What do you think? How do you think you can reach enlightenment? So even on Buddha's birthday, you cannot take vows and offer that up. So when you go out to Buddha, happy birthday to you, and P.S. I didn't buy you a gift because I'm a cheapskate. What? 24 hours? You can't even offer up your vows to the Buddha. 24 hours! You know, even 7-Eleven is 24 jam. Hello? What about you guys? 24 jam cannot hold your vows up. Shame, shame! 24 measly cheapskate hours. 24 hours you cannot sing now. 24 hours you cannot resist makeup. 24 hours you can't resist ornaments. 24 hours you cannot lie out. 24 hours only. 24 hours you cannot resist dancing. What are you, an Indian actress? You go home dance all day? Come on. 24 hours you can't kill. What do you work at the fish market? The wet market in the morning? Slice. Buck, 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 slice. Buck, 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 slice. Buck, 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 slice. With that birthday, don't slice. 24 hours you cannot. 24 hours you cannot drink alcohol. What are you? What are you? A dropout from AA? Think about it. 24 hours, only 24 tinsy, itsy, bitsy, teeny, weeny little hours. 24 hours you cannot wear perfume. Why? Why you got really bad BO? Shh, shh. Wash yourself more. And that 24 hours, come on. You know 12 hours you're in bed lounging around doing nothing with the aircon on sleeping. Right? 24 hours you can't take vows. Oh, we have to take 8 precepts for 24 hours. Oh, 24 hours. Ooh. I didn't say 24 years. I said 24 hours, not 24 years. They go, oh, 24 hours. Can it be 24 minutes? Oh, dear. And some people email in or write in. Can I take some of the vows and not that vow? I'm like, oh, someone want bargain, like discount. There are Malaysians living all over the world, let me tell you. Someone want discount. There are 8 vows. Can I only take 6 because I'm working? I'm with my family. My husband come home. We just got married. I'm like, oh. Even 8 vows want discount. How Malaysian? Think about it. Malaysians are great. They want discount and they really bargain. They go everywhere. They get a bargain. Hands down, salute. Not for your vows. This is for your enlightenment. 24 hours. Cannot come. Cannot listen. Cannot take the vows. And some more, before taking the vows, they're sitting there like, and then they go home like this. Don't talk to me. Don't say, don't ask me nothing. I don't want to break my vow. They're so uptight. They're so worried. And then when they finish the vows, they tell everybody, I took the vows for 24 hours. And want you to write them up in the newspaper. Star, front page, home. I took the vows, 24 hours. Big deal! Oops. 24 hours. And half of that, you're asleep, meditating on emptiness. Think about it. And cannot. And the reason we take the vows, the reason, you know, some of us, 24 hours cannot stop smoking, cannot. We are so holy because we're great, really advanced. We like to offer incense to the Buddha, you know. We cannot. So even 1 hour, don't offer incense to Buddha, cannot. Come on. We're afraid of the vows because we're afraid to attack our own addictions, our attachments. That's why we're afraid of taking the vows. Because we are afraid of attacking our addictions. We're afraid to attack our negative qualities. And therefore, you think, but I'm not, you may not be overtly negative, but everybody in this room, including me, everybody has a very strong sense of I. Me, 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 me. The stronger your I is, you can't take vows. The stronger your I is, the more you cannot take vows. Why? Because the vow is a direct antidote to the I. Why? When you take refuge vows, you already have to abandon things that feed your ego. When you take refuge vows. And that's hard for a lot of people. Because you feel, I have no more freedom. Actually, by taking vows, you get more freedom. People think, how is that possible? It's definitely possible. When you take vows, you get much more freedom. Why is that? You're free to do all the good things that you want. Any good things you want to do, you're free to do. Do you see the Dalai Lama running around in chains? His feet and his hands wrapped up in chains and ball and all that, you know, and locked in jail and say, oh, I have vows. I can't do anything for anyone. I'm stuck. No. In fact, people who have vows are free. People who have vows are more fun. People who have vows are more beneficial. People who have vows are more giving. People who have vows are more loving people. People who have vows are more wonderful people who are more free. Why is that? Because the vows tell you to do things that are positive and do more. Where got vow that says you can't love people? Where got vow that says you cannot have a wife? Where got vow that says, you know, you can't give, you can't show love, you can't forgive, you can't give good advice, you can't be generous? Where got vow like that? And those actions bring good results. So when those actions bring results, you have more happiness. Where got vow that says you can't tell the truth? You think telling the truth brings you negative problems or negative difficulties? Contrary, if you believe in karma, of course there's karma. So therefore, when we're afraid to take vows, we have a wrong concept. Why do we have a wrong concept? Because we feel we are restricted in our activities. Well, let me tell you right now, you are wrong. You are wrong. Taking vows, in fact, gives you immediate freedom. Why? You don't have to worry about people getting you anymore. You don't have to worry about people finding out your lies. You don't have to have an ego trip about, you know, what people think or competing or trying to be better or stepping on people or hurting people. You don't have to worry, and nobody comes and accuses you anymore. Even when they accuse you, that's the past. It's over. You have total freedom. People who don't have freedom is people who don't hold the vows. People who don't have freedom is people who don't live by the vows. Why is that? Because when they lie and they cheat, they lie. They're afraid to be caught, and they do more lies, and they do more lies, and more lies, and then they become more closed and closed. Why? Because when you talk to them to open up, they can't open up because you find layers. More and more and more layers. More and more. And there, one lie is interwoven with another lie, another lie, another lie. And it's many layers. So they can't open up and talk to you. Why? Because it's not just, okay, I lied about this in the end. No. There's many layers that are interwoven. And their whole reality will open up. Their whole reality open to you, and they're afraid they will lose your respect and lose your love and lose your care. Some of them underestimate people. They feel that if they tell the truth, they will lose their respect and care. Immediately. It might be so, but not ultimately. No. So actually taking vows liberates. That's why we call the vows self-liberation vows without the Mahayana motivation. Self-liberation. In fact, taking the vows liberates you. Liberates you. Why? You don't have to be afraid of all those actions that you normally do. That's one. Number two. When you take the vows, you plant the seeds in your mind. Listen carefully. When you take the vows with the correct motivation, wholeheartedly, you plant the seeds in your mind that in the future lives, this life also, listen carefully, whether you take the vows or not, your actions will be perfect. Your actions will benefit others naturally. That's why there are many people who are born naturally very good. Many, many high lamas of Tibet are born naturally beneficial for others. They don't need to take vows. Vows is just a procedural thing. You think the Dalai Lama had to take vows to stop him from killing people? Like, think about it. Do you think when Buddha Shakyamuni emanates in the world to teach or to help people, he's got to take vows to prevent him from being, you know, having 20 mistresses? I don't think so. So when you take vows, it creates the propensity, bacha, or the very powerful karmic imprint that in this life, depends on how much you cultivate, okay? And future lives, you don't have to take vows. It becomes procedural. So when you don't have to take vows, what is the meaning? Your habits have already been changed. From what? From loss of freedom to do good things or things that you want to things that you don't want? No! Taking vows gives you freedom. Taking vows gives you total freedom. Why? You will be born in future lives with money, with position, with friends, with a good body, with an attractive body, to do whatever you want, but the virtuous way. Some people are born with these attributes. Some people are born with these attributes of wealth and beauty and position, and it is the result of negative karma. Some people are born with these attributes, and it's a result of positive karma. How do you decipher what they do with these attributes? Some kings are born with these incredible attributes. Example, the king of Thailand. The king of Thailand that I've studied for a while are born with power, position, and name. And he does everything to make the betterment of his country. Therefore, his whole country sincerely loves and respects him. Sincerely. Sincerely. There are even laws about saying negative things about him. That's how much they respect him. And when you go there, you don't feel like repression. You don't feel like they're made to say it. You don't feel like they're trying to force to say it. No. They respect their king so much because he's dedicated his whole life. Even his children, he's dedicated. He's trained them up to lead the country after he's dead. That's his hope. My point is, he's born with position. He's born with power. He's born with rank. He's born with wealth. He owns the whole country. He can do whatever he wants. What does he do with it? And then some more, he promotes Dharma in his country. And when the monks come, His Royal Highness, the King of Thailand, will stand up for the monk. He's well known for the respect. He's also become a monk himself, short term. My point is, that is someone who has done that. Then you know people, you can see people, I don't want to name any names in the world because I don't want to get sued, that get position and power and name. What do? That people suck on their toe. They run around on yachts. They have affairs. They get divorces. They ruin their lives. They ruin their position. They derank themselves. They destroy their rank. They destroy their position. They destroy the respect of the people. And the more wealth and the more position and the more respect you give them, the more harm they do. What is that? That is a sign of a person whose result is, looks like, hey, you have money, looks like you look good, looks like you have position, and it looks like it's a result of good karma. No, as I've said many, many times to all of you before, don't be swayed or tricked by outer appearance. Outer appearance or superficial appearance of something does not denote it's good or bad. Some people in this life have to be born, inverted commas, not attractive. Why? In this life, if they're not attractive, their karma is that they can progress even more on their spiritual path. If they're attractive, they have more obstacles and problems. More. They attract more. They attract more suffering, more problems, more heartache. Some people are attractive. Some people are born attractive, and with their attractiveness, they have charisma. They look good, and they're quite mesmerizing. These people with attractive features and mesmerizing charismatic qualities, they can use that to bring people to something good, to bring them to the Dharma. Definitely they can. Definitely. So, some people have good looks, and what do with it? They end up in the gutter with a needle in their arm. Dead. Some of them go back to their families and become a total burden to their families. Some people are so beautiful, so wonderful, they do nothing but bring pain and suffering to their relationship, to their family, to their girlfriends, to their boyfriends, to their friends, everyone, because they drain them and they parasite off of them. They use them. Why? They can't control themselves. Some people's beauty is used totally to bring others to goodness, totally to bring others to happiness. And they use it to attract, they use it to sell, they use it to make money for others, for charities, all that. Their beauty is used for what? So how we use our, inverted commas, beauty, attributes, intelligence, wealth, position, power, rank, knowledge, how we use it will determine the reason we receive them. The reason. So therefore, just because you have certain things, people who didn't hear the Dharma will think, hey, that's automatically better than not having it. No. People who hear the Dharma, they have another reference point. Remember I talked about reference point the other day very strongly. People who have the Dharma, they have another reference point to judge these things. Some people have money, they have wealth, they have position, they have business, they have people who give them money, give them business, but actually they're locked in, they're in prison, and they're suffering. But they can't show it. Face some more. So whether you have or don't have is not the point. Please remember this for your meditations. This is not criticism. I'm trying to explain to you in very simplistic layman's terms the workings of karma and its results. That is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to explain to you the workings of karma. I am not pinpointing. I am not putting down. I am not complimenting. I am giving you a Dharma talk. And that Dharma talk is the workings of karma on a very simplistic level. And that is what, in this case, just because you have doesn't mean it's a result of good karma. Just because you don't have doesn't mean it's a result of negative karma. And if we keep thinking from that reference point, religion won't work for us, any religion. Advice won't work for us. Friends' advice won't work for us. Why? Because we already have a reference point. It must be like that. We have a reference point. Reference point is an experience from another part of our life that we use new experiences to compare with. So a reference point is something that we've experienced in our life once that was actually pleasurable or not pleasurable. And we use that as a yardstick to continuously judge and put into category new pleasant and unpleasant experiences. Example. If we walked in the forest when we were very young and we got stung by a huge wasp and our legs are swollen double its normal size, well, every time we think about the forest, we think, oh my God, the wasp, oh my leg. We judge everything. Not every forest has that, and everybody hangs out in forests. A lot of people go camping in forests. They don't have that problem. But we had that problem because it happened once to us, so we judge everything in the future by that reference point. And then maybe in high school, we had one girlfriend. We had one girlfriend, and she was the most perfect girl in the world, and we lost her for whatever reasons. We lost. So every time we get a new girlfriend, we keep judging the new girlfriend along with that first girlfriend we had. The hair, the look, the expression, how she reacted to us, how she was forgiving, how she was not forgiving, her size. You know, she's tall, she's small, she's fat, she's skinny, whatever it is. We always judge the next girlfriends on the basis of that. And our suffering comes from what? The suffering comes from our comparison. Previous experiences are not necessarily positive. Previous experiences are not necessarily negative. A new experience can be different. So when we hold on always, then some people are very afraid of taking vows and going into Dharma, inverted commas, deeply, whatever deeply means. Why? Because they look at their parents, and they look at their parents, and they look at their grandparents, and they use that as a reference point of what deep Dharma is. Can't eat this, at this time must offer this, cannot move the deities. You have all types of cultural restrictions. And therefore, these cultural restrictions is what's been classified as religion or Buddhism in this culture. And therefore, from that reference point, we've been taught temples solve our problems, lamas have magic and solve our problems. When we have problems, we go to Kuan Yin temple and we do a divination stick, and that solves our problems. And if they don't solve our problems, that temple is not powerful, find another temple. And if that lama's not solving our problems, we go to another lama, because another lama is more powerful. Actually, there are people running around saying, I go to different lamas to see which one's the most powerful, and I will follow the most powerful. I'm like, that's true. There are lamas, there are different types of lamas, different attainments, but are you powerful enough to follow the most powerful? Because the most powerful will train you up very fast. The most powerful will go 100% into training your mind. Are you ready for the most powerful? So don't be running around for a sports car and driving in a sports car that's extremely fast in a sports race, a car race, if you're not ready. If you only know how to ride a bicycle, you want to drive a sports car and you want to go for a race, you think about it. So people say that, I go for the most powerful lama and the highest lama and the biggest lama and the one that shows me magic. And I'm like, but are you qualified? I go for the biggest initiations, the highest yidams. I don't go for that cheap lamrim stuff and the cheap Shakyamuni. Ah, look at him. He doesn't have any, only two arms. How? Some more begging bowl. It means he want money. Why? Begging for money. I'm going to go for the exotic dates. I'm going to go for Yamantaka. I'm going to go for Hiruka. They got more arms. They hold more things. They're more exotic. They got more faces, more eyes, more legs, more everything. And I want it. Me, 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 me. Give me. And you're looking at them like, huh? Why do you go, huh? Because the whole reality is gone. The whole reality is off. So they relate religion with a past experience. So therefore, when they come to, especially Tibetan Buddhism, why like that? Why like that? And they put Tibetan lamas in a box. A lama cannot talk like this. A lama cannot act like that. A lama cannot dress like this. A lama cannot move like that. A lama cannot eat like that. A lama cannot eat this. Sometimes they ask me, you eat meat? I say, yes, and kill it fresh. And the aunties in like Ipoh, they go, listen, Miss Mahayana. Dear. Yeah, they actually asked me, you eat meat? They should see me now. Got hair too. Oh, dear. Yeah, that's right. Got hair too. And more. Stick around, auntie. I got more to show you. So they read Chukin Trungpa's book. You know, they said, they read Chukin Trungpa. They go, some of the lama can have facts. Why like that? They're operating from what reference point? They're operating from the reference point of what they're used to and what they think can be. And so therefore, they judge that reference point. They come here and they have that judgment. And they say, it cannot be like that, cannot act like that. And they say, well, you know what? Lamas talk very nice. Lamas talk very soft. Lamas are very gentle, and lamas are very easy, and lamas are very giving, and they talk with a very beautiful, wonderful, eloquent, very gentle speech. And then they meet Tenrinmachi. And they go, why like that? Why like that? Why can talk like that? I don't understand that. Why he can talk like that? Nah. I know my motivation. Do you know yours? And they judge. They judge why. And they use this judgment not just for lamas. They use it all over the world. You cannot believe what I've been accused of. You cannot believe. I've been accused of so many things. I've been accused of stealing. I've been accused of tying people up and beating them up. That's S&M. I've been accused of, wait a minute, stealing tankas and statues. I'm like, tankas and statues steal? Can you see me? Cat burglar inside, put a Buddha in my bag and run out. I don't need to steal statues. People give it to me as a gift. Let me see what else. Oh, I've been accused of, listen to this, prostitution. Oh, yes. That I would sell my body for money. I love it. If I can sell myself, you know what that means? It means I'm gorgeous. Gorgeous. How many of you can go out there and sell your bodies to get money? How many? I'm gorgeous. More. I don't mind at all. And let me tell you the truth. Buddha in his previous life jumped off the hill for the tigress, because the tigress was very hungry and she had cubs. So out of great compassion, in one of his previous lives, he jumped off the cliff, offered his body for her to eat. And that propelled his bodhisattvahood another few levels. So in future lives, he can reach that level. If Buddha can give his body to a tigress, why can't I give my body to a tigress? I mean, what's the big deal? Look, if there is no method left, listen to me carefully. I'm going to say this live. If there's no method left and it's a save Ganden monastery, something like that, that the monks are starving, they don't have anything, and I can sleep with someone, get a couple of million, get to Ganden, I'll do it. I'll give my vows back, I'll do it, then I take my vows back. What's the big deal? It's just a body. Anyway, I'm going to throw it out. So if I can do that, instead of saying, oh, so bad, you say, oh, so good. Who wants to sleep with that old bat? With that old cigar-smoking dato. Ew! Think about it. If I can offer my body up in that way, why not? Why not? So people, okay, cannot this, cannot that. You cannot do this, you cannot do that, you cannot talk like that. Why not? If I'm here and I need to scold someone and it'll make a difference in their mind, I will scold them. For not scolding them shows you how restricted I am. In fact, it shows you how tight and narrow I am. All the great lamas scold. All my high lamas, they scream at the top of their lungs, and we shut up, and we listen, and we say, oh, let's not upset Rinpoche anymore, and we do something about it. The effect is there. I've been screamed at by most of my lamas, not all, most. Yeah, some of them I don't hang around long. I mean, if you see some of your lamas once every 10 years, I'm not going to scold you. How are you? I'm fine. How are you? Here's the offering. Thank you for the merit. See you later. I mean, if you live with your lama every day, of course you're going to get scolding. You're going to get abused. You're going to get screamed at and shouted at because you have more opportunity to be corrected. You have more opportunity to be trained and to be loved and to be cared about. And if you run away from that opportunity, you're stupid. If you run away from the training, you're stupid. Why? Because the lama loves you enough to break his mold to take care of you. He loves you enough. So people who criticize that, they're actually stupid. A bodhisattva can give his body. A bodhisattva can give his speech. A bodhisattva can give his reputation, give his name, give his wealth, give his fame, give everything to help you. A bodhisattva can do that. I'm not going to run up and down Bukit Bintang and say, for sale, help Ganden. Can you see me wearing a t-shirt? For sale, help Ganden. You know why I'm afraid of that? Because I'm afraid now I'll be rejected. Say, too fat la. Never mind, I can work out again. Just give me 4 months, and I'll be, no, okay, five. And I'll be beautiful again like two seasons ago when I was walking up and down the aisle, the catwalk. I'll be beautiful again. I know I can, you know, with the bones. I used to walk around the street, when I was doing my shows, you know, I used to walk around the streets like this. I want to make sure everybody see my cheekbones. Oh! Just you wait. Next time we have initiation, we'll tell him it's March 14th, and he shows up, and we show up on March 13th. Just you wait. That's right, I used to walk around streets like that. You know, I used to walk the street like... All the time, I want to make sure everybody sees my bones, and I wear all these cut-off shirts and show my belly off and all these little jeans and stuff like that. Now I wear Hawaiian mumus. I wear Hawaiian one-piece size-fits-all mumus. You can fit a sumo wrestler the size I wear now. But it's all right, because underneath all that, I know I'm beautiful. That's what Christina Aguilera tells us. You know, we're really beautiful, and your words can't hurt us. So I keep telling myself. So what's my point? My point is this, you have to give yourself for anything. You have to sacrifice yourself for anything. Of course, some things that you don't need to do, you don't need to do. Look, if Buddha on the boat, another previous life, Buddha on the boat, killed one person to save 499 people, I'm not going to ever kill. Ever. Never. Not even an animal. No way. I'd rather starve to death. If you put me on an island with me and the chicken, I die. I would die. I can't. Really, I can't. It's not in me. It's not that I'm holy. It's not that I'm so wonderful. It's not that I'm a high lama. I just can't. I just can't do it. I can't. Really, it really bothers me, killing things. I can't. It's been with me since I was a child. It's very natural. I can't kill. So if I'm on an island with a chicken and me and there's nothing else to eat, I'm not going to eat the chicken. No way. So I'm not going to kill. But if I'm in a situation where many people will die and it's dependent on this one person, I will beat that person up. I will slap them. I will stop them, tie them, whatever I can. If I have to, I have to do the unmentionable. Why? It's not that I want to. It's that, what do you care more about, them or you? So I'm able to do that. If I have absolutely no choice for Ganden, I can do almost anything. I can live in Malaysia. I can have a Dharma center and deal with committee members. I can deal with all types of people who can't make it to puja and teachings and don't transform after 10 years. 10 years later, I can't change, it's so hard. It's okay, buy your coffin. What else can I tell them? Buy your coffin, get ready, lah. I'll do your funeral when you're dead. What else can I say? So what happens is this, is that for Ganden, I can do anything. Yes, I will teach. I will repeat myself. I will suffer the weather. I will get a center. I will do pujas. I will raise money. I will live in a foreign country. I will live against my will. I will live in a place I don't want to live. I'll eat whatever I have to eat. I'll diet my body so that I can bring Ganden to prestige. For me, I did all types of things in order to show that lamas can do other things and bring other people to the Dharma. If I do work that is not conventionally Dharma, Example modeling. Example acting. If I do that, it is to touch a whole new crowd and whole new people that could have never been touched because they feel they're not traditional. I want to break that barrier. So later I can put in my portfolio, I was a model. They go, oh really? That itself will attract people. Why will it attract? Because llamas and models are opposites. One is all about desire and looking beautiful. One is about giving up desire and looking beautiful. It's totally opposites. So someone can merge that together, then the people who would never come to Dharma, never study Dharma, would come to the Dharma. That's why I did it. There's a lot more reasons too. So like that, if I can do, and I had to go through many years of dieting, I lost 30 pounds. 30 pounds. I don't know how many kgs that is. I lost 30 pounds. And it took me 3 years to lose 30 pounds. And when I was doing the modeling stint, I ate grass and tomatoes and seeds every day. And I ran every day. And I had to work out every day. And I was really teeny. Now I'm like 95 kgs or something like that, 96. When I was doing the shows, I was 82. And I kept it that way. I kept that way because that's what they wanted. I even paraded in bikinis up and down, you know. Some of them tricked me. I go for a fitting. They say, you wear that. In the evening, they say, okay, you're going to do the bikini. And I just wear a teeny little black bikini. And I'm like, oh my God. And some of my Dharma students saw me. I don't let them come to the shows because that's fair. But one of the shows, the one time I said, okay, you can come to the show, they made me do the bikini one. I was like, can you imagine me parading up and down with my big yellow butt? I said, oh, never mind. I said, why am I attached? Anyways, it's going to be a corpse anyways. Let it go. It's for the Dharma. Why is it for the Dharma? Why is running around in a bikini for Dharma? The bikini is not Dharma. Running around is not Dharma. It's my willingness to do anything to promote the Dharma. My willingness. I'm willing to do anything. So, if someone's going to give me a couple of $1 million and it can be given to Ganden, yes, I will sleep with them. But I won't do it right now. I haven't reached that level. And hello, look here, kids. When I say level, I didn't say I reach. Look here, everybody look here. When I say level, I didn't say this level, that level. I don't have to. I can do other ways to raise funds for Dharma. I can teach. I can make books. I can make videos. I can beg. I can tell people, poor me. So what's the big deal? So people want to say, hey, you know, he does this and this and this. No, I do. In fact, I'm complimented. Anything related to me being beautiful, hype it up. More. Anything. You know what? He's a gigolo. Sanku. Sanku very much. It's a compliment. Secrets. Shh. How many Tibetan lamas can be a gigolo, take a good look? How many? There's like maybe 100 or 150, 200 Rinpoches on the planet, in the world, you know, I mean, teaching wherever, out of Tibet. How many of them would you pay to have extra services? How many Rinpoches would you even consider? Think about it. So if like one or two out of the whole country can come out and can be a gigolo, thank you very much. Thank you. It's a compliment. Just think. Just visualize some of the Rinpoches. No offense to anyone. Visualize some of them. Eating yak meat. 300 kgs. Wearing robes. You know, like. Do you think they can be a gigolo? Why do I get accused of it? Why don't they get accused? Take a look! Take a look at them! Why won't they be accused? This is almost, if I take this off, it's a god! It's a god! Jeez! So it's like, whatever. That's why you guys like me, because you're kind of get accused of all kind of things too. People in this room, I'm telling you, people who are in the room right now and people who come to this room are people just like me. They do the best they can. They get accused of everything. And they're not conservative people. Why? They're not called conservative, not because they're not conservative. They dare to do something else to make it. They dare to be different. So people say, oh, everybody's wearing white and you're wearing blue. Dun, 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 dun. Everybody's wearing orange, you're wearing purple. Dun, 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 dun. You're a divorcee. Oh, big deal. Get in line. Yes. 8 times. You mean you had before married? Ow. With even a milkman. Thank you. I mean, you know, when you say things like around here, people go, oh, and they put you down. They don't look at what you've done. They don't look at your merits. They don't look at your accomplishment. They don't look at how hard you work. They don't recognize. That's why I like to do that. I like to recognize what people do. Especially successful people, you deserve it. Famous people, you deserve it. You did it. You went. You slept through the hard work. You slayed up all night and worked while we were sleeping. You put up with the garbage. You put up with the bad press. You put up with the insults. You put up with the people said that you can't make it and you proved them wrong. Kudos to you. I like that kind of people. That's why my group is weird. Doesn't fit the mold. Is not conservative looking. Look at all of you guys. I wish I could take a picture and show yourself. Some of you are like, some of you are like, just look at yourself. Look at Maggie over there. I finally got a smile out of her. She doesn't ever smile at anybody. Miss Maggie never smiles. She smiles, it's your good luck. Run and get the 4D. So what's my point? My point, look, we're that type of people. What kind of people? When we dare to be different. We dare to have rumors. We dare to have people accuse us. We dare to do something for others and get blamed. We dare to break conventions. Not the law. Don't run around saying, Rimaji said, break the law. No, don't break the law. Break conventions where we are people like that. And look at us. Look at me. Look at me. Some people say when they made me, they broke the mold. I told them there was no mold. They just made me and threw me in the world. There was no mold. I'm the leftover for all the other llamas' leftovers. And they put it together and say, oh, go, dear, is that going to work? And Buddha said, try it, lah. What do we got to lose? That's right. So they molded this llama. There was some leftover clay here, another llama here, and then even here, and here, and here, and all these leftover here. They put it together. And then Tsongkhapa showed Buddha, Kenna. Buddha said, no choice, lah. Waste not, want not. So they threw some energy down, and I'm like, oh, where am I? Why? Hello? And I think most of you are just like me. You don't fit the mold. See, our Centro's credo, our Centro's kind of motto is, do it while you can. That's right, just do it while you can. Do it while you can, why not? But with a good heart. Dress as you like. You want to come in here with this open, pushed up? Okay, your choice, lah. But when you bend over, it's not my problem, the momo will spill out. So what's my point? Even Mama Jenny over there in back laughing. She's 120 years old laughing at sex jokes. Bad auntie. Encouraging us young people to talk about sex. Bad auntie. Ow! So what's my point here is do anything and everything that you can with a good heart. And for the purpose of others, don't be afraid to take blame. Don't be afraid to take criticism. Don't be afraid to look bad for someone else. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Every Rinpoche will be accused of different things. Every teacher, everybody will be accused of different things. They look at you and they say, what can they accuse you of? I mean, really, they're going to look at you and say, what can they accuse you of? They're not going to accuse Fidel Castro of being a gigolo, are they? Hey, you're a gigolo. No, what? Hello? They're not gonna accuse Chris of good photography, are they? What's my point? They're not gonna Chris here. Dot Ming, can you raise your hand? Oh, that's Dot Ming, the one in the white shirt. They're not gonna accuse him of having a hang up about shampoo, are they? You know which shampoo gonna make my hair shiny and long and smooth and full of volume and you know. Yeah, they're not gonna look at him and say, you know, he's got a big hang up about shampoo. It's like, can you imagine that? So you think about that. So taking vows is what? Taking vows is a direct antidote to your fear. It is a direct antidote to your hang-up. It's a direct antidote to what you are afraid of. And when you take vows, you don't lose anything. In fact, you gain. Temporal gain and long-term gain. Why? Because when you take vows, A, object, motivation, and the vow taker, the recipient, is very different. If you take vows in front of the law, on a law book, and I'm gonna be a good lawyer, blah, blah, you break that. Your cohorts and your peers and the system and the government lose respect for you, but it stops at that. But if you take vows in something higher, such as a Buddha, it's not a matter of losing respect. In front of the Buddha, if you offer a candle, you can fulfill your wishes. The Buddha has the power to help you to create the merit to fulfill your wishes, ultimately and temporarily. Therefore, if you offer something powerful to the Buddha with a powerful motivation, then it's very powerful to fulfill one's wishes. Similarly, why do you always have to offer the traditional candle and incense? Why do you have to offer the traditional flowers? Why can't you offer effort? Why can't you offer vows? Why can't you offer something that you feel attached to? Why can't you offer that? If you, in fact, offer that, it will be more beautiful than flowers, more illuminating than candles, much more, and smell much better than incense. Do you think the Buddha became a Buddha and worked so hard, 3 aeons of meditation, giving his body, taking vows, and holding on his practice and becoming a fully awakened being? Do you think he did all that so he can sit there and get incense and candles? Do you think he did that for that? Well, that's all we're offering Buddha. Right now, at our level, all we're offering every day is incense, candles, some flowers, some water, some mandalas. That's all we're offering. We're not offering what Buddha really would like you to offer. What is that? Your practice. When you offer Buddha your practice, who gets the benefit? You yourself get the benefit. Why? You will start seeing a transformation. When you see that transformation and you offer up that to the Buddha, actually you're offering the 2 types of Buddhas. The ultimate Buddha and the external Buddha. The external Buddha is Lord Buddha. The internal Buddha is your Buddha potential. You open it up even more. So when you make that offering to the Buddha, you open up your internal or secret potential, your Buddha nature mind. And at the same time, you offer to the external Buddha. When you offer to the external Buddha, the merits collected from that will be the manure for your crops to grow. What does that mean? When you make external offerings to the 3 jewels, the merits you collect, when you actually do the meditations, when you actually do the practices, you will gain the results. Why? Simply engaging in practices will not gain results because you need merit. So therefore, when you make external offerings to the Buddha, when you make external offerings, you collect that merit. Then you are making internal offerings to the Buddha inside of you, which is your potential. So therefore, when you take vows, it is very, very powerful, direct Dhamma practice. Why is that? Because, A, you're giving up your fears. B, you're accustoming yourself, acclimatizing yourself to a new mode of thinking and a new freedom. Because we feel when we take vows, we lose freedom. You gain freedom by taking vows. How can you lose freedom by doing virtuous work? How can you lose freedom by doing virtuous work? In fact, you gain freedom. You gain respect. You gain love. You gain happiness. You gain help. And you gain companionship from engaging in positive actions. And at the same time, you make an offering to your internal Buddha. That internal Buddha is you, the I, Da. At this moment, contaminated. But the contamination can be removed. And that I becomes enlightened. That I becomes an enlightened being. And how do you make that I enlightened? By bringing its true nature out. How do you bring its true nature out? You bring its true nature out by acting in ways that bring its true nature out. So at this time, if we need vows to restrict us or to help us or to guide us to find our Buddha nature, that is the purpose of the vow. So therefore, when we take the vows, inverted commas, please. It restricts us from doing actions that increase attachment and desire and anger, and increases actions that help us discover the opposite of those negative qualities. So therefore, when we take the vows, when we take the vows, it is not an external vow. It is words of truth. It is something that is natural within us. How do you know it's natural? Let me give you proof. When someone smiles at you, how do you feel? When someone helps you when you're in trouble, how do you feel? When someone gives you food, how do you feel? When you fall, someone picks you up, how do you feel? If you feel good, then that's a natural state of mind. How do you know it's a natural state of mind when your mind feels good about it? I mean, unless you're, a serial killer, well, I feel really good when the blood is gushing out. When I slice their neck and it's gushing out, I feel good. No, you don't look at sickos and psychos like that. I'm talking about us, normal people. I know all of you are thinking, which one of us is normal? Rajeshwar is looking, who's normal? Nobody up there, though. So, what's my point? My point is, how do you know it's natural when you do it and you feel good and the other person feels good? That's natural. That's your natural state of mind. So hence, my point, when we take vows, it looks like we're being restricted. We're not. And anyways, why would you want to do negative things to harm other people that bring you negative results anyway? Why? So if you take vows, you're afraid of that? No. In fact, you should be afraid of not taking vows. Why? Also, another good point about taking vows is it helps you to create awareness. Then you think, oh, I swore in front of the Buddha, my refuge. I swore in front of the Buddha, the one I trust. I trust no one in this world. Actually, for me, I trust no one, just the Buddha. I trust no one. I trust in no one's methods. I only trust in Buddha's methods, the Dharma. Therefore, I trust in Buddha. I trust in Buddha's methods. And I trust in Buddha's servants, the Sangha, the real Sangha. I'm not talking about half-past six Sangha who walk around the center pretending like peacocks thinking they're attained. I'm talking about real Sangha. I take refuge in the Sangha because they can never lead me wrong. And anybody else below that, anybody's below that who lead me wrong, I'm not going to be disappointed. I'm not going to be upset. I'm not going to be angry. I'm not going to be anything. Why? It's expected of them. That's their nature. So therefore, because I trust the Buddha, I wish to achieve that state. And I trust that what he teaches me, the Dharma, helps me to find liberation. Do you know what liberation means? Liberation just doesn't mean enlightenment. Liberation can be right now. And that is to be free of the fear of the results of negative karma and negative actions. How do you become free from that? You don't do it. You don't do it. How do you not do it? In the beginning, maybe you can do it by sheer will. But if you have vows, it's even better. Because vows create awareness in your mind. In the beginning, it's a little difficult, but it becomes easier and easier and easier with time. And it becomes natural. Like I said, in future, this life and future lives, you don't even need vows. It becomes procedural. You naturally are already habituated in your new way of, your new mode of benefiting others, new mode of existence, which is not harming others. That's why in Tibet, they revere reincarnated lamas so much. They believe that they come back with natural good intention. They come back with natural good mind and natural good practice. I'm not referring to myself, although it's going to look like it. I'm telling you in general. That's why they revere on that basis, is that these people have trained themselves for many lifetimes, and they come back. So whatever they do, whether it looks good, looks bad, looks black, looks white, we trust them. Why? They have methods that are beyond this world, due to many lifetimes of practice. We have that confidence in Tibet. And they have proven themselves beyond a doubt many times. So in Tibet, disrespecting a Rinpoche, a real reincarnated Lama, not one with a title, not a person with a title in this life, but a real Rinpoche, many lifetimes of practice, a real Lama, it's considered very detrimental. Why? One of the vows of the Mahayana vows is not to degrade, denigrate, or hurt, or harm, or say negative things against a Bodhisattva. There are 10 levels of Bodhisattva, not only Kuan Yin. So when we have doubt, when we say negative things, if we take sides against the Bodhisattva, for an ordinary person saying negative things, we take sides against the Bodhisattva, the action is very detrimental. How is that detrimental in the future when you come in the presence of a Bodhisattva? You will not be able to perceive it's a Bodhisattva. You cannot perceive. Not at all. You will always see that person as an ordinary person. Always you view that person as wrong, ordinary, or doing wrong things. It's very dangerous. That's why we train with Guru Devotion. In Guru Devotion, we try to view the Guru as pure. Whether the Guru is pure or not is not the point. We try to view the Guru as pure in order to develop pure view. When we develop pure view, our whole reality changes. So like that, It is said that when we take the vows at the most auspicious day, I can't give you a full explanation of what auspicious means, but I can tell you this. If Buddha chose tomorrow, can you turn that off? Thanks. I don't need it. Yes, thank you. If Buddha chose tomorrow to enact his virtuous deeds, then tomorrow must be an excellent day of doing virtuous deeds. So if we do virtuous deeds on a virtuous day, chosen by an enlightened being, then the deeds is multiplied greatly, thousands and thousands and thousands of times. And hence, that's why we take vows on special auspicious days. One of them is Wesak Day. It can be Lama Tsongkhapa's birthday. It can be any saint's holiday or whatever. All right? And that's one thing. And the second thing is, it collects a great amount of positive potential and merit in a short time. Why is that? Why? Because most of us in this room don't do things that are in the vows anyways. Most of us in this room don't do a lot of these things in these vows that we're not supposed to do. But simply not doing it doesn't collect any good merit. Doesn't collect anything. Nothing. Nothing at all. Rabbits don't kill. Doesn't mean they collect the merit of not killing. Collecting and not killing is having a long life, a good body, pleasant appearance, and being born in places where what you need and what you want will come to you with no problems, and continuously. So therefore, not killing has a lot of direct and indirect results. So a rabbit doesn't kill. Doesn't mean that the rabbit's collecting positive karma. A retarded person in a wheelchair that doesn't know anything, that's blind and deaf, I'm sorry to use that example. A mentally challenged person who is in that situation, I'm sorry to use that as an example, that they don't do these kind of actions doesn't mean they're collecting good karma. It's neutral. It's nothing. So similarly, not engaging in the action does not mean you are not collecting good or bad karma. Similarly, a young child, an infant, doesn't kill, doesn't steal, doesn't lie, doesn't commit sexual misconduct, doesn't wear perfume, doesn't wear jewelry, doesn't have affairs, nothing. But that doesn't mean the baby is collecting positive karma. You don't go, oh, baby, namo amitofo. Right? I mean, use your brain. Who goes up to a baby and goes, namo amitofo? You don't kill, you don't steal, you don't lie, you're a saint. Put them on a throne, worship them every day. Who does that to a kid? Nobody, right? Since nobody does that to a kid, that tells you that not doing it doesn't mean you're collecting virtuous karma. I'm giving you logic now. I'm giving you logic to think. I'm giving you debate to think. I'm giving you food for you to think carefully through and through. Since you are graduates from school, most of you, some of you look like you just ran out in the jungle. I won't point any fingers. Some of you looks like you just ran out in the beauty salon. Some of you looks like you haven't eaten in a week. Emotional revenge for that ugly shot he took of me. You have photographers? Cannot. You don't have photographers? Cannot. I'm going to really throw a diva fit. Only certain angles. That's it. I'm going to throw a big diva fit. Okay, now. So therefore, not when you take the vow and you're already not doing these actions, then you're collecting merit. Oh, it's very powerful. And then some of the actions you find difficult to do, you're not doing. Okay, I make an exception today. I think not killing is very easy for everybody in this room. Not stealing and taking things without permission of this owner is easy for most people in this room. Right? Avoiding sexual contact, I think all of you, 24 jam. Give it a rest. 24 jam, no bubbly can, right? Can. Justin's like, 24 hours. Yeah, you go back to sleep, wake up, go run outside, take a whole shower, and already the vow finished. Okay? Okay, number four. No lying and deceiving. 24 hours can, like, even your business people. Can, 24 hours can. Okay. No intoxicants. They wrote here toxicants. It's intoxicants for people who've not studied English. I won't tell you who typed that out, but it's not the president of the center. Avoid intoxicants, not toxicants. Next thing she's like, avoid toxicology. Oh dear. No alcohol and tobacco and drugs, except for medicinal purposes. So if it's medicinal, you need to smoke a cigarette butt, smoke a cigarette butt, not medicinal, otherwise your hand's shaking, what? avoid eating more than one meal a day. Okay, that's going to be a little difficult for some people. Can you imagine Koki in front of Buddha? Oh. Make the clock go faster, please. Another 23 hours and 55 minutes to go. I'm starving. Yes. So, that one, okay. And what you do is you go to sleep and you wake up before 12, you have your lunch. After you have your lunch, you got to eat it one meal. You can't have a little bit here and 30 minutes to eat another 30 minutes. That's cheating. Just one meal and finish it. No break in between, okay? You have your lunch, afternoon till midnight. You don't have any food. But if you have gastric or your stomach is screaming very loudly and it's embarrassing you, you may have some milk with some water or some juice that's diluted. No undiluted direct food. The point is what? The point is disciplining yourself. And some of us need to take this vow for about 3 months, okay? And during that day, you try to avoid meat, eggs, onions, garlic. Right? Don't go crazy. Don't go to the mamak store. Ga onion, ga garlic, garlic naan, ga garlic. You know, some people are very intelligent. One garlic naan, please. And then they're like, does it got garlic? So the waiter from India goes, why we write garlic? No garlic lah. Okay, so because garlic and onions are considered foods that block the wind channel. When we do higher tantric meditations, okay, listen up everybody, because when I say higher tantric, everybody's like, okay, when we do higher tantric meditations, no joke, later for you goody goodies who stick around, who's loyal, who listen, who got good guru devotion, who's all goody gun drops and walk up and say, can I have initiation? You'll get it. Then later we'll talk about it more. Not now, because now you're infants. So I'm not going to give you a Maserati right now. Okay, what I give you is a rattle. You play with it. So what happens is this is garlic and eggs and onions, chicken and pork and fish in tantric system are considered foods that block the winds. So when you do certain types of meditations, those foods block the winds. You don't have to avoid it forever. But certain meditations, certain times, certain practices, you avoid. Okay? Just like after you take a shower, you know, you avoid the air con, you avoid the wind. Who in this room takes a shower and stand in front of the fan? You know, it's just simple procedures to help your body coordinate better. So those are foods that is to train us for higher practices in the future. Higher practices, okay? And avoid sitting on high, expensive beds or seats with pride. Also sitting on animal skins. Well, animal skins, you know, is not really in thing anymore, so we don't need to talk about it. Any of you own, you know, tiger skins, bear skins, furs, and minks? Don't wear it anymore because it's out. It's been out for the last 10 years. You wear that, it's really out. It's imitation furs now. So it's really politically not correct. Not correct. Okay? So avoiding sitting on high expensive beds, meaning with pride. You don't go home and then throw your mattress on the floor and tell your husband, I took a vow, we got to sleep on the floor, dearie. Go sleep on the floor, no meat and no sex. Sorry. He's like, no more, don't go to Kichara House anymore. No, it's not about that. You go back and you sleep on your bed, but you sleep on a bed like this. You sleep on a bed thinking about all the people who sleep on the streets. Think about all the people who don't have a place to sleep. Think about all the people with no blankets. Think about all the people who every night have nowhere to sleep, sleep in boxes, in plastic bags, on the gutter, in the alleys. And from where I come from in America, there's a lot. It's very difficult to walk down the street and not cry, for me. So that's why we have KSK. We do that on Saturday nights. We give food to people. Every Saturday night, our center gives food, and we're going to expand that to a soup kitchen and more. In any case, think about those people, and therefore, break their pride. And then when you sleep in the bed, don't think, oh, I have a beautiful bed. It's big, and I'm so good. I'm so wonderful. See, just sleep on a bed and think, I'm going to rest my body. Okay? And avoid wearing jewelry, perfume, makeup. Avoid singing, because jewelry, perfume, makeup is used specifically to attract. We wear perfume so that when someone walks by, the pheromones go off. We wear makeup, unless we're Tammy Faye Baker, to attract. Some of you don't know Tammy Faye Baker. Look it up on the internet. Scary. We wear makeup to attract and to get people to look at us. I mean, for men in these days, it can be gel, it can be aftershave, okay? It's equivalent. Whatever you're using to attract the opposite sex or the same sex, whatever you're into. Jewelry, you know, if you have your marriage ring, you don't have to get rid of your marriage ring. You're not wearing that to, you know, like, show off. In fact, some of us think it's a prison. We'll have to get rid of it. Oh, I took the vow. No. You don't run home and say, I can't wear my marriage ring for 24 hours and hang around in Geylang. Or Chow Kit. Oh, I took a vow, you know. I can't wear the ring. Your wife's like, I'm going to talk to that lama. No. Your marriage ring is okay. Okay, you have your Buddha pendants. That's not jewelry. You can wear your Buddha pendants. Jewelry you wear to specifically, you know, make yourself, you know. No. 24 hours can what? 24 hours. All right? And if you find it very difficult, now you know why you must do it. If you find it very difficult. Okay? And let me see. No singing. Any of you cannot sing for 24 hours? No, you can't. And if the radio comes on, a nice song comes, you slip, just catch yourself. Remember, there's four intents. You have to have four intents to break your precepts. Just simply doing it doesn't mean you broke your precept. Like you go out with friends tonight, you know, you have supper, or tomorrow you have supper or something like that, or lunch. I'm sorry, not supper, lunch. And you slip, you eat pork, you know, uh-oh. You didn't break your vow because you didn't want to. You didn't say, okay, I'm going to eat pork, I'm going to order it, you know, get a kill, bring it here, and then, you know, you didn't do that. So if you slip by accident, you didn't break your vow. Okay? And no dancing. Some of you don't even have to take that vow. I don't think you can dance. I don't want to be mean, but you know, some of you I don't think can dance. And I don't want to point any fingers, especially at matronly, elderly, respected ladies of society. It's not very polite, but let me just peek in that direction. So that one is, I know that lady's thinking, ah, yeah, no problem, no dancing law. I can't even dance. Nuts? Okay. I still can't get over the nuts on the throne. So it's got three varieties. Sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, and cashews. It's like, you know, like, oh, how are you guys today, you know? did you have trouble driving here? How was your day at work? I don't understand the nut thing, but never mind. It's an offering. They even put pills up here in case I get a fever because I have to wear 50 meters of cloth.